Good evening, everyone. Welcome to National Liberty Alliance's weekly conference call. Today is Monday, December 3rd, 2018. We broadcast live every Monday from 9 p.m. till Eastern, 9 p.m. till midnight Eastern time. If you're listening live over a radio or another network and you would like to ask a question or make a comment, our call-in number is 605-475-3250, and our access code is 449-389-pound. If anyone would like to email a question, you can send your questions, that's plural questions, at nationallibertyalliance.org. Also, please support our business partners. You can find their banners on the right-hand side of our website, which the proceeds goes to support NLA's effort to save America. Also, please support NLA by donating $5 a month or more. Click on the donation tab on the top right-hand side of our website. Okay, we're going to pick up tonight's scripture reading where we left off last week. We're just starting now, first verse of John, Gospel of John, chapter 9, first verse. And we read, and as Jesus passed by, he saw a man which was blind from his birth. And his disciples asked him, saying, Master, who did sin, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? Jesus answered, Neither hath this man sinned nor his parents, but that the works of God should be made manifest to him. I must work the works of him that sent me while it is day. The night cometh when no man can work. As long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world. When he had thus spoken, he spat on the ground and made clay of the spittle, and he anointed the eyes of the blind man with the clay, and said unto him, Go wash in the pool of Siloam, which is by interpretation sent. He went his way, therefore, and washed, and came seeing. The neighbors, therefore, and they which before had seen him, that he was blind, said, Is not this he that sat and begged? Some say that he is, others said, He is like him. But he said, I am he. Therefore said they unto him, How were thine eyes opened? He answered and said, A man that is called Jesus made clay and anointed mine eyes, and said unto me, Go to the pool of Siloam and wash. And I went and washed, and I received sight. Then said they unto him, Where is he? He said, I know not. They brought to the Pharisee him that aforetime was blind. And it was the Sabbath day when Jesus made the clay and opened his eyes. Then again the Pharisees also asked him how he had received his sight. He said unto them, He put clay on mine eyes, and I washed, and do see. Therefore said some of them, some of the Pharisees, This man is not of God, because he keepeth not the Sabbath day. Others say, How can a man that is a sinner do such miracles? And there was a division among them. Okay, we'll pick up the rest next week, Lord willing. And that was the Gospel of John, chapter 1, and we read through verse 16. Okay, let's see. I saw Carl was in the room. Carl, do you have a mic? Can you talk, or are you busy doing the radio? And I guess he's tied up. All right, anyway, like everybody should know by now, of course, that our course is open. We're moving forward on that. I think we're opened, we're opened quite a few chapters, I think, now. I think I saw that Carl had moved things over. People only get through about four chapters, or four parts, not four chapters. Chapters are quite long. But four parts, and let me just take a quick look here. 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Looks like we're opened all the way up to chapter 6, the beginning of chapter 6, all through 5. So we've got quite a bit, loaded up on that study. So if people haven't started that study, it's something they want to really consider. You know, I've been sending out some emails, making some notes that, the course is up there and people need to take this. If you haven't signed up for the course, you really do need to do that. We the people cannot save the nation, and it was going to require the people to save the nation. Regardless of what President Bush is doing, if the people don't take control and bring justice into the court, we'll only end up back where we started from here. And, our nation will be as just as our courts. A lot of evil things have been going on for quite some time now in our government, causing all kinds of havoc in the Middle East and other places. The works of our nation in the name of the people have been a lot of evil things going on. And our courts are a mess. We have a lot of crooked judges and attorneys, and they control the whole process. No one's ever going to indict them. Only the people would do that. we don't have justice in the courts. It just doesn't exist, and it probably hasn't existed for quite some time, especially if you're dealing with a problem with the government itself and you're trying to use the courts in order to bring these people back into good behavior, or even to try to get them indicted. So, again, we the people are the only ones that can really take this back, bring back justice into the courts, and therefore, bring back liberty, because our liberty has been eroded so seriously. All right. I don't particularly have a subject, so we're going to kind of move along. If anybody wants to get into the queue, star 6 to get into the queue. Let's see what else we have here. Is Jen, are you here? Looks like you're here. Do we have any questions? Do we have any questions? Anybody that wants to make any announcements or anything also? But we'll do the questions first, I guess.
Okay. This one is for Brent, and possibly you have some insights into it. What, if any...
Is Brent here? I didn't see him in here.
Brent. No, I don't see him yet. Unless he signed in on a different number.
All right, we'll read the question. Maybe I can respond somewhat.
Okay. What, if any, difference is there between a lawyer and an attorney?
Good question. I think attorney somehow is identified with the bar. I'm not too sure on that. And that definitely is a question for Brent. Many of our founding fathers were lawyers, and they did go before the bar. I don't know that they didn't have anything called a license or anything, but they must have some kind of certificate or an approval. And going for the bar was really is a test, of course, just like it is today. But the test was not controlled by the Bar Association, but by the people themselves and the courts. I guess there's maybe some traditional questions they may have asked and so on and so forth, and a conversation took place. And I remember there was some writing about Thomas Jefferson when he went before the bar, and a lot of notes were made that he was, his responses to those who were questioning was far above those who were questioning him. So he had some really deep insight and understanding of law and process, I guess. Again, I don't know what kind of questions he was asked. But that's how I know. I did see that recorded in history on how that went. But as far as an attorney, an attorney, I think, has to be, again, we're going to need Brent probably to answer that. I'm looking to see if he's in, and I don't see him. So, but anyway, I do think that an attorney is a special title for someone, I think, that has the ability to be represent certain individuals in the court. But I don't know anything more than that. All right, any other questions?
Yes, the second one is, our township and school district had in place a $15 a year head tax or occupation tax. The township received $10 and the school $5. This year, the township did away with this tax, but the school district still continues to collect it. Our school or property taxes are very high in our district, and I want to contact the school board to ask them to eliminate collecting this tax. It's a nuisance tax on top of our school property taxes. Not sure if it would be a fruitless effort to try to contact them since it's such a small amount, but it's the principal. And of course, if I fail to pay, they will put a lien on my property. Any suggestions?
Well, it's a battle we're all fighting, not necessarily that particular battle, but tax problem, whether it be for property or income. And again, that's one of the reasons why we're here, fighting to take back control of the courts. But it sounds like this is a tax only in that school district. Is that what they said?
Right. It's a local tax for the school district.
Yeah, they don't have the power or the authority to do that. Only Congress can make tax, and so I think that has to be on a state level, or a federal level where they, talk about taxes. So I can't see how a county could do it, and we're talking about a school district, which is much smaller than a county. So I have no idea how they got that authority. You know, what could be done is challenge the authority. I would try to challenge the authority first through letter writing and see where that goes. And if they really want to do something about it, you could do a show cause. They can look into the law and see what the requirements are for taxing. And I'm sure you'll find that it can only be the state level. The state level has the ability to set taxes. Now that I think about it, maybe the county does too. I'm not sure how that works. Maybe the state sets the amount of tax that might be collected, for instance, on a sales tax, I'm not sure. Are you aware of whether the counties are the same in your state, Jan, or if all the counties are uniform in that, or is each county maybe a little different here or there?
In Pennsylvania here, there is a personal property tax, and that pays 99% for the school and a few bucks for other things. So it's basically a school tax, and it's assessed by the township you're in, mm-hmm. which is what this sounds like.
Right.
Also.
Well, that would be correct to be assessed that way. But the question is this a uniform tax across the whole state?
No,
Did the state
not.
Set this up? That's the question.
No.
And if they didn't, they can challenge the authority. And see, what is a lawful tax, is it state only? And I think it is. The counties, as far as the county taxes, whatever you purchase, and I'm talking about sales tax particularly, and I'm sure there's other things. I'm trying to think if there could be other things. Again, I don't know how that's set up. I've never really looked into that. But anyway, a little research can give you the answer to these questions, and if you can discover that they don't have the authority, then you can challenge that authority with a show cause. By what authority? You can file that with the local court. What state is this in? Did they say?
I think it's in Maryland, but I'm not positive.
Right. Well, anyway, the court... the state court in Maryland, whatever they call it, here in New York it's called the Supreme Court, every county, of course, has a court, New York State Supreme Court, county, Dutchess County, Orange County, whatever county you're in, gives a location. But in any event, in that court, you can probably do a show cause by what authority. And I guess that's... But again, a person has to do their homework to discover, by what authority is taxes set in your state. And I'll bet you that it's going to be at the state level alone. All right, anything else?
Just several announcements. We are still looking for grand jury administrators. We're very short. I think we have something like 1,050 or 60 out of about 13,000. We also are short on volunteers to call members to bring them up speed, and members to introduce new members to the website, show them where to go, get them started on a program, foundational study. And we still need some more speakers for the natural healing call. I think we're down to this week is our last speaker. So if you know of anyone that would is either in the business of natural healing or knows of someone who is, they don't have to be a member. If they have an interesting topic, just have them email me, Jan@nationallibertyalliance.org, and we'll take a look at what they've got and get them on the program here. We've had some interesting ones lately, and we're looking forward to continuing this. And that's about all that I have. I guess I should mention that the natural healing calls are generally 35 to 45 minutes with question and answer after that, and lately we've been running over and getting into the next call, so we've had some interesting times, but 35 minutes is adequate with a Q&A. So if you'd like to step up and tell people what you've been doing, why, by all means, just send me an email, and we'll be glad to talk to you. And that's about all I have, John.
All right, thank you. We're also looking to get the word out to what we're doing here. You know, again, if the people expect to be ignorant and free, forget about it. It's not going to happen. And I listen to people, you know, now that I've become reasonably educated, I listen to people that should know the law and should know what's going on. And that's including judges, too. And I discover, alarmingly, they don't understand the law at all. They don't understand the Constitution. I mean, even up at the highest level, you listen to some of these people talk, senators, congressmen, et cetera, and they talk about having to go talk to a constitutional lawyer to understand something. I mean, this is pretty serious business of serious, serious problems. If you have to go talk to a bar attorney in order to understand the Constitution, and of course, if that's a requirement for that individual, then they lied when they raised their hand to take their oath, and of course, these are the people that are in office. They don't know. The common person doesn't know. People don't even know what liberty truly is, and again, another problem. They don't understand. That is our heritage. That is our American heritage, is our liberty, and to understand what that really is. People think they understand, and I used to think I understood what it might be until I learned it and realized I didn't know. Now I know. But anyway, education is the key. We have to get people educated, and at some point, you know, if you can get enough people educated that is controlling the processes, you know, if the people take control, and we take control of our courts, then at some point, and of course of our political process too, because we need committeemen across the nation, and we need quite a few of them. Thousands of people need to be involved. But again, it only takes one person in a county to be able to take total control of the committeeman process and bring it back to order. But people need to know what is the order that they need to bring it back to. They need to bring the law back. They need to bring integrity back. They need to bring statesmen back. And so they have to become educated in order to understand these things. But if we can take back control, if we the people can take back control of our courts, even if it's with a skeleton crew, so to speak, and the same thing with our nation, in theory, you know, again, we'd have to control the courts first. But in theory, we only really need one person in every state to take control of the committeeman process. That's something we should be talking about at some point. If people have questions on that, we can talk about that a little bit. But definitely we have to address that on a higher level in the near future. Our focus first is, of course, to take back the courts, because that's the key. You know, we've heard what Trump is doing politically, or what he did do. You know, his focus was on the Senate, because that's the key. Congress wasn't all that important. Of course, it would have been nice to take control of Congress. And it's the same thing here. The key for us is to take back the courts. If we could take back the courts, we could take back the political process. We can bring law and order back into our courts and therefore into our neighborhoods and, force these individuals who are, quote-unquote, our leaders to obey the law and not to, go beyond the authority that they've been given. But again, we need to take control of this. And once that happens, we can then start pushing a heavy education throughout our entire nation, starting, of course, within our schools. And we do have a plan for that. We'll talk about that in the near future. But right now, of course, the big focus is taking back the courts. But if we can get an education to the people, if we can get a minimum amount of people to take control, then over time we can move education, a proper education, into our schools concerning civics and the Constitution and the law, of course. The only way we're going to be able to take control is through education. We can't do it if we're ignorant. We have to know how, and we have to know what things mean. If we have to go see someone else to find out what the Constitution means, that's pretty sad. If we are people of law, and the Constitution, which is a very thin book, there's not much to it, and if we can't understand that, which controls our nation, then it's a pretty sad state of affairs for us. But that does seem to be where we're at. It's a pretty sad state of affairs for us. All right. Let's see. Brent is not in yet. I don't see him. He may not be in tonight. I know he was traveling. He was still traveling last week?
He was last week, but I'm not sure of this week.
All right. I see Gerard's in. Gerard, you there?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. All right, I'll pass things over to you for the control of the board, and I'll sit back and respond to questions and answers with you. I guess we'll go right into Q&A. But go ahead. I'll give you control.
Okay. So
anybody wants to get into the queue, star 6 and then a 1, star 6 and then a 1. There's only two people there. So.
Yeah, Christopher, Pennsylvania. Go ahead, Chris. You've been unmuted. Hello, hello.
Hello?
Yes.
Oh.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I'm breaking up pretty bad.
Oh.
Yeah, it does sound like he's breaking up a little bit. How am I? Am I coming through okay?
Yeah, you are.
Okay. Do you want to reboot, Gerard?
I'm sorry, what?
Do you want to reboot? You are breaking up.
Yeah, I'll reboot my mic first, but go ahead. Let me ask you a question.
Yeah, go right ahead, Chris.
Yeah. Well, one thing. Have any of you guys read the book? I guess it comes from you guys. I got it at the Amazon. It's a UCC connection, How to Free Yourself from Legal Tyranny.
Repeat that, because you were breaking up, too.
Oh, sorry. The book I got. The UCC Connection, How to Free Yourself from Legal Tyranny.
Well,
I got it from Amazon. It's stamped in the back from National Liberty Alliance. And it's got the Founding Fathers on the front, like some of your other books on your website.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, that's not our book. You know, freeing
yourself.
It's
not on your website, but it's still, like, the front cover looks like the ones you do have on there. Well, anyway, reading it.
Is there any way to send a link on where this book is located? Or what is it, on Amazon, you said?
Yes, Amazon.
And what's the name of the book?
The UCC Connection, How to Free Yourself from Legal Tyranny. This for about $5 is all it is.
I think this is from that guy up in Maine, John.
Okay.
Right, he does a lot of
that. I just wanted to get
that.
The name. You said it was the UCC Connection?
Yes.
And what else did it say on it?
How to Free Yourself from Legal Tyranny.
How to Free Yourself. Legal Tyranny. I'll have to look into that. Does it say anything about who authored it? Who the author is?
Yeah, it's a guy is from a speaker, a seminar or something, Freeman. Something Freeman. This other guy put it together, part of his speech there. But it talks about how
and they put NLA's
the court.
Name on it?
Pardon? No, it's
NLA's
on the. It's got the front cover, looks like the ones you have on your site. In the middle, it shows the founding fathers, presidents. And then below, it says, we the people, and it's got the shadow form of all the people standing there. And the back cover, down towards the bottom, it's got your website, nationallibertyalliance.org.
And on the back, it says the 10 maxims of commercial law, John.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, that's David Robinson that does that. He uses the cover and stuff and then puts stuff out. He's got
he's talking about a particular subject matter that we don't get involved in. And look at the UCC is law. It's just misplaced law. They're applying it in places where it shouldn't be. And the UCC, well, again, that's the commercial code. I'm not sure what title.
One thing he talks about is how to use it. He said if you get pulled over for the statute, whatever, he said to write one thing to put on your driver's license, write it on there, without prejudice, UCC 1-308.
Right.
And that reserves your rights to work it with common law.
Well, we're familiar with the idea. We're familiar with the... that particular code, but again, it has nothing to do with us, so why we would quote anything or use anything as far as the codes would only bring us right into, under the authority of the codes, ultimately. We're bringing ourselves into a jurisdiction we don't want to be in.
Well, what this guy's talking about is how to avoid being brought into their jurisdiction. He says I thought you might find it very interesting. It talks to the topics there. But one of the things about it in it is, I'd have to go in front of the magistrate, and he wouldn't, like you was just saying, they don't know the law. And I bring up these points not to let them put me under their jurisdiction, and he doesn't know it or ignores it. Now I've got to go to like a court of record or something. So how do I appeal it? Do I tell the magistrate I'm appealing this and he has to do it? Do I have to see someone at his office and fill out a certain type of form? Do I go to the county courthouse? I mean, how do you do an appeal?
Well, again, it depends on, you'd have to say what kind of case you're talking about. You're talking about maybe some kind of a code violation on your property. You talk about driving problems.
Nothing really. I'm just trying to prepare for the future, study things.
Well, look,
a cop pulls you over for whatever, and you go to the magistrate, and not to let him put you in your jurisdiction. If he doesn't listen, you'd need to appeal it. Maybe you'd do better at a court of record. I mean, or anything. How do you put in an appeal?
Well, look, it's not necessarily something you appeal from. I'll give you an example of what I do. If I get a ticket, for instance, I'll send in a paper, a short paper, challenging, their authority as far as having any jurisdiction. Some of the times when I do that, I think I'd like to say half. I think that's pretty accurate. Half the times when I send a paper in, I never hear anything back from the court at all about anything. Period. It's just gone. The other half of the time, they start back and tell them I got to come in. They got a date and blah 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 blah. At that point, it's not for me. From my perspective, it's not worth fighting. You can only get yourself into deeper problems. You might want to go in if you want to make a little argument with the court, but usually they'll set up another day for you to come back and so on and so forth, and you're going to frustrate them more, and there's nothing more dangerous than ignorance in action. And so people will find themselves in jail. We've had people who have pressed the issue on certain freedoms, and they've ended to the point where they forced them into a psych evaluation. And it just gets too deep. It's just not worth the battle. You know, we want to fight the war. We can try to win as many battles as we can, but the war is what we have to win. So I wouldn't push the issue too far. And again, you know, it stinks that we have to deal with this kind of a problem, that we don't truly have our liberties. And again, you know, all of our liberties are really in jeopardy. There's very few liberties that we really do have. They control everything, you know. Yeah. Even our speech, they control. Our right of due process, they control and they ignore. You know, you can go all ten amendments, and we can find problems with every single one of them that these people don't adhere and don't respect and acknowledge our liberties. So it can become a problem. And definitely I wouldn't battle it with the man on the land thing. If you're going to battle a situation in the court, you want to learn as much as you can about the process, about what is lawful.
Well, that's what I'm trying to do now, is to learn about it. That's one of the questions I had, which I didn't understand.
Well, to be able to make your argument, okay? But if you want to learn that, then take the course. That's what our course is all about. I assure you.
Well, I intend to. But I mentioned before, I only have access to a smartphone, and I can't seem to access it there. So tomorrow, the day after, I'm going to go over to the library and use one of their computers and see about getting on. I even got an email sending the link to the course. And I click on that, and I'm just at the front page, and I can't really get into it.
Through the smartphone, I don't know. We'll bring that up to Carl to see if there's anything we could do about that from our side. I don't know. But I could tell you, anybody who goes through this course, and if they really, really, you know, buckle down and do their studying, take notes, and learn from this course, you will have enough knowledge to be able to go into the courts and make good arguments and deal with your legal needs. But again, remember, you know, there is no, they have concealed, okay, the courts of law. You know, there's two jurisdictions, law and equity. And equity is when a judge, an individual that we call a judge, sits and makes a decision, one jurist. And of course, there's an appellate process through there. You can appeal the decision. The other is law, and that's when the jury rules. Unfortunately, they've taken control of the jury, and they call it civil court, and they've made it a statutory process, where a court of law is not to be a statutory process. It's supposed to be under the common law or the natural law. And that's how it's supposed to run. And the people decide, you know, without, you know, being infringed upon by the judge or by a prosecutor. But again, that's the and people don't realize that. So how do you go about if you want to go into court and you want to open a true court of record? And we've opened courts of record, but they're not really acknowledged as courts of record. They refer to common law as... you know, in the federal courts, they'll refer to that as federal court decisions, you know, on the federal level, the district court decisions, and also, of course, appellate decisions and the Supreme Court decisions. If in the state, it's the same way. They call it common law, and that's using, you know, decisions from the local courts. And, of course, that's not law, nor can be used as law. But they do. They use it, that, and combined with statutes. And they can make anything say anything and make anyone guilty of anything. It's a serious problem.
Well, so this book I mentioned, Guy goes into a lot, gives examples of going into the court and how they'll do that. And he says about going like Jesus said, you go in as a lamb amongst wolves. Don't go in there with a chip on your shoulder. You go in and play dumb. They ask you about the chart. You tell them you don't understand because they can't go forward if you don't understand.
Yeah, but what you're going to do is frustrate the court. You know, look, at we used to make these arguments, and we've been involved with people in cases that literally go for a year. They keep coming back. If people have that kind of time to keep going back. And the arguments they're making, you know, and it's really, you know, just usually a fine. Not that we should have to pay that, but again, you got to ask yourself the question, how far am I willing to go? And am I willing to go to jail? Because at some point you piss them off enough, they're out for your blood, and then they won't let you go. They want you. Because it's an ego thing, I guess. It's, I don't know. But
the point I was going to make was, the point I was getting at was about, you said about the different jurisdictions. What he says on there is corner, putting the judge in a corner to admit which jurisdiction. Tell him, my memory ain't so good. What part I can remember, I was, you asked him, is this a criminal or a civil case or something like that? And then
right.
the judge will
that's,
say,
that's the proper
no,
question.
It's a criminal. And then that's where he asks, well, I'm still confused because there's only criminal is common law and admiralty like that. And they won't not admit to be an admiralty. And the different steps he goes trying to avoid it, but you
yeah,
keep
but again,
asking
you're
the
not
questions
get anywhere.
And you finally force him into admitting that it's statutory. And that was has no, how do you call it,
well,
rules,
no
really. It's like it's all hidden, and but I'm not explaining it too well. But I said,
look,
you just agreed it, and you understand what I was trying to.
Look, we've been
badly expressed.
There was a time. There was a time when the judges understood the Constitution, and people like Carl Mueller would go in there and rest on the Constitution and win the case. They've taken these judges and they trained them. When somebody like you comes in and starts asking questions about jurisdiction and is this admiralty or what is this, civil or criminal and all that, that's right away they go into their backup mode of which they've trained them to do. And so what they'll do is they'll start asking you questions and they'll try to confuse you, and then they'll say, I think you're confused. I think you need a mental evaluation. The first thing they'll try to do is stick you in a mental hospital. That's the beginning of circling the drain to go down this long path, because they will not give you justice. And then they'll make you. Then they'll say you're crazy. This is what. This is where we are in America today. They're not. They're not operating under justice. And yes, their courts have absolutely no jurisdiction over us, except due to the fact that we cooperate. If everybody refused to cooperate, if you can get all the people in the town, especially like on a traffic court, and say, look, this is a Nisi Prius court. You only have authority unless we challenge it. And the minute we challenge it, you don't have it, and we're not going to put up with it. But you're not going to get that because people are sheep, and you're never going to get people together. And if you do it on your own, they're going to throw you in a cell, and they're going to say, you're sick. Oh, poor man, he's sick. He doesn't understand.
And you have to be educated.
Yeah, I recently heard someone that had that happen to them.
They do it all the time. I was in court with my daughter, and it was a clear case. And right away, the attorney that she had, who was the public defender, he says, why don't you take her for a mental evaluation? I said, wait a minute. You know, I didn't think of it at the time when I was there. No, if my daughter needs to go for a mental evaluation because you had two cops beating her up for no reason, I think the cops need to go for a mental evaluation. I'll send my daughter for mental evaluation after the two cops are declared mentally stable, because I think they're mentally unstable, you know. So you have to know, you know, what's going on, and they understand how to get you upset and put you under pressure. And the minute they ask you something you can't answer, then they build on this dialogue that they got going, and pretty soon you're over there stuttering and stammering. Next thing you know, the bailiff's taking you away. So you just got to be real careful about, you know. And look, you could do a lot of fighting on paper. You know, if you can do it on paper, and John knows this too, you can't get in contempt of court on paper. So, I would try to fight most of this stuff on paper. And like John says, at some point, if you're not getting anywhere, you acquiesce. Now, they also know that a lot of people that are educated in the Constitution and in the criminal process can drag them out for a long, long time. I mean, we've had people who are still in their houses 4 or 5 years into foreclosure because they keep filing papers. They hate that because this is all about money, whether you know it or not. The end result, that statute with the blindfolds on, justice and the scales, guess what's in them scales? Money. And that's all it is. So if you file an intelligent sounding paper and you articulate, a lot of times they drop the tickets because you're not worth all their time and effort. You understand? So you're like a porcupine. It's just as easy to stay away from you. But you know, you have
I've been getting information from all over, and one of them mentioned, I didn't know whether it's true or not, was that once you file a paper with them, you're automatically putting yourself under their jurisdiction.
Well, it depends
on what you write.
Right, right. You could protect your jurisdiction filing a paper with them. Because look, you can't tell me that I can't file a paper with you. Suppose I'm suing you. I'm not allowed to file a paper with you.
Yeah, you could. First of all, if you start your paper off that you're responding here on, by special appearance, okay, you're there to test, you know, whether they have jurisdiction. And look, here's the key thing. You know, if you really want to battle, let's say you get caught in a situation where you're in jeopardy of jail, because some of these towns will put you in jail for this or for that or whatever. And if that's the case, then of course you want to battle it. The very first thing you want to do in those cases, and you do this on paper, don't do it in a court because it's worthless in the court. You need to get it on the record, okay? And whenever you say anything in the court, you, first of all, you want to make sure that there's a recording of the court and also that there might be a record that you can get at the end of the hearing here, you know, a full record of what's been said. And you can make notes if you have to speak in the court. The first thing you want to do is you're here by special appearance. And then you want to say something like one and for the record and make you state your statement. But I wouldn't do it that way. I would come only by paper. I would not get in there with a challenge with the judge back and forth. But I would challenge is tell them, I wouldn't challenge it. I would tell them they don't have personal jurisdiction. They don't have jurisdiction over the person and they don't have jurisdiction over the subject. And now they have to respond, and you need to get, for instance, maybe some U.S. Supreme Court rulings out there that you can grab a hold of and put in there that once challenged, they must prove on the record that they have jurisdiction. They must prove it. So let them try to prove it on the record. Now, they'll try to say some kind of BS, and whatever it is, you don't care what it is because they don't have the jurisdiction. So whatever they state is really you can use against them. And then you can demand that the court case be dismissed for lack of personam jurisdiction and even subject matter jurisdiction. Now, of course, they're not going to do that. And if you're serious and it's a serious situation where they might put you in jail for something, that's when you move it to federal court for cause. Now, as long as there's a number on that case, you don't have to pay to move it into federal court for cause, okay? So you can move it into federal court for cause, and the cause, you're challenging jurisdiction. They don't have it. And you can write in there exactly what the judge said on the record on what he thinks jurisdiction is, and that would be real stupidity from the judge's perspective of whatever he has to say because he doesn't have it. So that will work on your side. And you're only going into the federal court, really, to make get a decision on whether they have jurisdiction or not. And, of course, you have to have a good wherefore clause. It needs to be short and sweet. I would not do a paper in the federal court challenging for cause anything more than 2 or 3 pages, okay, at most, and get right to the point. You don't need to discuss the case. You don't nothing what you're there for, just the fact they don't have jurisdiction over you. And on your wherefore clause, you want a cease and desist order. For either a default or they can't prove it and they lose. That's what you want, cease and desist. And that's one way to win the case and beat it. Now, I don't think a federal judge is going to put himself out on the limb and put himself in jeopardy to stick up for some town court judge to give jeopardy on, I mean, to give them some kind of a, agree that they have some kind of a jurisdiction over you. Especially if they said something really dumb with how they think they have jurisdiction. You know, I remember one case we had where the judge said he had jurisdiction. Well, you know, this, that, or the other thing. Well, I have jurisdiction because I said I have jurisdiction. Let's move on. Now, I'm kind of paraphrasing, but something like that was said. Just the fact that he said he had jurisdiction thinks he gives jurisdiction. So that's how dumb they could be, and that would be great stuff to put onto the paper. Again, you want to get the court record. Should be a stenographer there, and also you'll want to get a copy of the what do you call it, audio file, okay? Once you mention that in the court, they won't deny it that they don't have it. As long as you're inside the court and it's operating and it's recording your voice and their voice, they're not going to lie. But every court case is supposed to be recorded from the town level all the way up.
Well, like I said, my first question was, I don't even know how, I'm assuming most people are like me on the part, have no idea how to do any of this.
That's right.
I don't even know how to put in an appeal, let alone do these papers you're saying. Where do they go to? Who do they go to and what courthouse? Do you have any of that information? Maybe you put something together in a booklet.
Yeah, if you want to learn this, take the course, because that's where you're going to learn this.
Well, that's it. Oh, it's in the
court.
That part.
Forms. We're going to give you some forms that, which will be really looking on how to work with the common law process. You know, you don't have to use their forms. Forms are there for you to keep things uniform, on point, and kind of control the conversation. That's what the forms are really there for. You know, keep you on point. And that's good. That's good. We should use forms as much as possible. But we can also just use them as a guideline. We can add and take away on those forms. You can create their own forms. Look, they have, for instance, there's no way to get into a court to open up a true court of record. They trap you at the door. As soon as you come in, they're not going to let you in the door unless you do a number of things. Number one, they want that statutory fee. If you don't have that statutory fee, you're not getting in. Once you pay that statutory fee, guess what? You just gave them jurisdiction, and you also, of the jurisdiction you're going into, which is a statutory jurisdiction. Okay. Yeah. They also have a civil paper to open up a civil complaint or whatever they want to call it. Okay. And you fill that form out. There's nothing common law about it. There's no way you can open up a court of record in that. So you can change the words on that and add. Then you can challenge the fee. Okay. Say, this is, you can't charge me for justice. And you can make an affidavit concerning your conversation and the way you tried to get into the court. First order of business, once you're in the court, you want to file a paper with the judge saying, I want my money back. I don't know why these people took my money. I don't want to be in a statutory court, and so on. And the judge is going to tell you, whatever he wants to tell you. We did this in one of our cases recently, and so we have on record the fact that the judge refused, okay? So now you've got evidence here of a fact that you're trying to open a court of record. You've written it up properly, and that's a simple way. Once you understand how to write papers, it's very simple to open up a court of record. It's only adding a few sentences in there, and maybe a footnote or two defining certain words like the word court of record or common law. And then you want to push towards that issue. Now, I'm working on a case, that's one of the arguments being made, and we're working on a gun case, and that's an argument that's going to be made. We're also preparing to do another case to sue the judiciary, and the case will be made in that case too, because the whole purpose of that is to prove and show the concealment of a court of record or a common law court or a court of justice, whichever name you want to have for it. They're all the same. And so if you read those cases, you're going to learn, especially when you compare them and you see the similarities, you can learn, well, okay, I just got to write my papers around my facts. You can use a lot of the language and the quotes and the law and everything else that's used in these cases. You know, if you want to learn how to write a case, you read cases, okay? And, a lot of the decisions are very, very important because that's the controlling factors, or supposed to be the controlling factors in a court. Marbury versus Madison. Okay, a very important case to read. But there's numerous cases. There's about four cases in particular that people should read. And I'm sure more than that, but four or five that are really very important. Once you understand the anatomy of a court case, okay, which is what we're going to lay out in the course, the anatomy of a court case. You know, what paperwork is required in order to file a case, okay? What paperwork is required to make a motion, okay? And also some of the concerns you have to have on what the other side's going to do. They're going to try to have the case thrown out. And, And they'll use what's called, on the federal level, Rule 12. Okay, they have state level, same thing. They have rules which, you know, throwing you out for not stating a claim or for not having proper service and so on. There's about five or six different things that they try to use to throw you out. Well, again, you know, we're developing a new strategy on that. And it's something that probably should be applied into the case, you know, when you file the action in itself. But again, you know, everything is a form, ultimately. And we're going to create forms that will help people to get into a common law court. Now, of course, we have to achieve that. We haven't achieved it yet. I'm not aware of anyone that has achieved it in the past couple of decades, at least. You know, people, because of ignorance, okay, you go to the penal code, which is UCC 18, Title 18. That's where the penal code is found. Well, if you go look at the jurisdiction, it's maritime law. That's how they got it through, okay? And they're utilizing maritime law on the land here in the federal courts and calling it law. And with that dumb,
it's just Keller law.
That we don't do anything about it.
I'm sorry.
The book here, UCC Connection, he talked about that the courts don't even want to hear common law. He said, and this guy has made arguments with Supreme Court cases, and he finally found out that the judge wouldn't hear it. He talked to the judge later. He found out, he said, if you're familiar with it, there's a case in 1938 that had to do with it. That's where they won't hear any Supreme Court cases unless it's after 1938. And he said the thing to get it into common law is the UCC, that's without prejudice, UCC 1-308, and that makes it in conjunction
to
work in harmony with common law.
That's like walking into a court, clicking your heels, and think you're going to be transported into a court of record. It's not going to happen. You're only going to piss them off. But what you do want to do is learn to play the chess game, okay? Use their language, use statutes against them, make it clear that they don't apply to you, they apply to them, and you do that in a very subtle way inside of footnotes. You don't want to broadcast it plainly on the paper, okay? They don't like that, number one. Number two, they're lazy readers, and they may not even pick up on what you said until later, and you're really writing.
Well, I'm not still making an argument about going into the court and fighting. I'm just saying how it mentioned it. That's that they're not wanting to hear anything about common law. They want to use the statutory.
Let me tell you something.
They are bound by the UCC, and that one part, 1-308, makes it where you put it in notice, and you reserve your right. Now it has to work in conjunction with common law.
How about getting onto the paper in a subtle way that the whole process is a fraud on the people?
Oh, yeah.
How about getting it into the way where they start to discover as they look deeper into your paperwork and they start to realize that they are in jeopardy, okay, because you've plainly laid it out what they're doing is subversion, okay? Mm-hmm. But again, it's got to be subtle. It's got to be something that's just – isn't loud on the paperwork. Because
speaking of subtlety, it works both ways. They have subtle ways of getting their stuff through. They wrote the UCC. They have loopholes for themselves, and they've been getting found out. And so there are people, like you said, nobody's done it. Nobody's been into a court record since whatever. But if they have, you'll never hear about it because they stop immediately. They settle out of court. They don't ever let it go on the court record. You know, if you get the judge in a horn dilemma, he's going to bail. And there's been a change in the courts that I've noticed, and I don't know if anybody else has noticed this, but you'll see that they're bringing the prosecutors up front and center a lot more than the judge. They're keeping the judge back because he's really not supposed to be front and center. He's not supposed to be practicing law from the bench, even though they do it blatantly. But lately, even in the local courts around here, and I don't know if anybody else on this call through America has noticed, you know, they'll bring the prosecutor in there at, like, let's say a traffic case. Like, by the second appearance, he's there, and he's answering. And really, it's up to him to answer the jurisdictional stuff. The judge is supposed to know the law and hold him to the law, but I've noticed that the prosecutor is taking more of a front and center. See, once you get the prosecutor in a horn dilemma. That leaves the door open for the judge to do something. If the judge steps on his tongue, you know, it's hard for him to get out of it. But if the prosecutor does something, the judge could do a wink and a nod, and they could dismiss your case and get you out of there. A lot of times, if you're really good, they don't want you in front of the people educating them, and they'll get you out of the court. There is a change that's taking place right now. The whole UCC things are people that have exempted themselves through the proper language and filing the proper papers, and they're not liable. They removed themselves from the system legally using the UCC, which is a whole big process that you got to be, you know, really up on to even think about doing, because don't forget, they wrote it. It's for them. Now, yeah. Can you crack the code? Sure you can. But the thing is if you're standing up in open court, besides maybe cracking the code, you can also end up in jail, like John says, because they got lots of sneaky methods to get you to step on your tongue yourself, you know?
Yeah.
So look, I think they're going to get better as this whole rule of law comes back into, all of a sudden, you know, they're talking about rule of law on the federal level. You know, lately, the last thing we had is there was some statements that all federal crimes are commercial crimes. That was something that they were pushing through. That, you know, they would lie. That's where they want to be. They want to be in the commercial. You know.
Yeah.
We had a member.
No, go ahead.
We had a member filed some paperwork in the UCC level and was able to get money out of it. It was about $100,000. And they sent him a check, and he cashed the check. And after he cashed the check, they came out and arrested him for fraud. Or they tried to get him. Actually, he was able to escape because he just happened not to be home that night. When they raided his house, they knocked down his door, frightened his wife, his kids, and so on and so forth. And last I talked with the guy, he was still kind of on the lam, and that was quite some time ago. But the thing is they said, okay, let's give this guy some money. He's looking to get money from us anyway, using the UCC, and then they went after him for fraud, okay? The IRS, for instance, will try to get you to sign a paper. Once you sign a paper, you're done. You're fried. They got jurisdiction over you. You just agreed. And you'll never get away from that one, okay?
Well, you know.
Once you participate with them. Huh?
There's a lot of misinformation online, and it's purposely. It's on purpose to mislead you.
Yeah, some of it probably is, yeah.
It absolutely is. I'm sure of it. I'm sure that they got their trolls out there putting misinformation out, you know, and they're putting all kinds of stuff out. You know, that guy that got money, you know, you can get money out of your SESCU account, but you know what? You're going to have, unless you're a private banker, you can't do that.
They don't like you. They don't want you to come in to play the game with them.
That's right.
Look, the whole thing, you don't want to go into this game. And also, when you get into the UCC stuff, you got to be talking on the federal level. You're not going to be able to talk this kind of stuff in a local court, the town courts, and you're not going to be able to really even discuss it or get involved in the state courts. You're going to be trying to play this game with the big guys who play chess. And understand exactly what's going on. They understand the fraud that they're playing. They know where the risk is for them. And you come in there, they'll tell very quickly that the people coming in there ultimately don't know what they're doing to begin with, okay? If they discover that you might know what you're doing, they might be a little nervous with you. But if you're looking to really make money somehow, because ultimately you're going to do a lawsuit and the end is really looking for the money, unless you're going in for a true injury, okay, a real injury, you know, being abused by the bureaucrat or something, you know, by the court or whatever, you know, it's really not something you want to mess around with. You want to just stay away from it. It's just not worth getting into it. But again, if you're in a situation, town court, because that's what you started talking about, you're in jeopardy.
Well, I'm not in any situation. I'm just thinking.
Yeah, but you mentioned
that's
the kind of court you're talking about, though, right? On
yeah.
the town
court. Well, those are the courts that everybody comes in contact with frequently and probably first. Eventually, you get into the bigger courts because you got probate, you got this. I just had a big probate nightmare. I'll tell you about it, John, today. They're so ridiculous. It's horrible. But anyway, go ahead.
Well, when you go into the town court, if you're in jeopardy of jail, if you're in jeopardy of losing your home or something, I mean, now you got to fight tooth and nail. You're going to fight. And the only way you're going to really fight these people is to challenge a jurisdiction, persona jurisdiction, okay, to begin with, subject matter jurisdiction. They don't have it. Get them to write something stupid on the paper or put on the record. Get a copy of the record. You take the number that's on the case. And again, you're right, you do have to understand a little bit on how to file papers and the forms and, you know, how to move things over. It's really simple once you kind of get the big picture, like the anatomy of a court case. But, you know, then you move it into federal court for cause. Your only argument there is jurisdiction. You're not arguing whatever, nothing else. You're not arguing about your house. You're not arguing about driving without a license. None of that stuff. You're there saying they don't have jurisdiction. You're challenging that. And, again, there's no real big issue that the federal judge is going to be concerned with, that he's got to maintain the status quo, okay? You know, on the one hand, the status quo involved with this is giving power and authority to the town courts. I don't think a federal judge is going to do that. I think he'd be quite dumb to put his himself into jeopardy there. So you should be able to win and get the decision in a court with a good wherefore clause that says cease and desist, leave me alone and go away. Don't come back no more, you know? And
well, speaking of the court cases, you guys' suits against all these branches, you said they've just ignored it, now you're doing something again. What's happening there?
Well, it depends on what suit you're talking about. We have situations that, you know, if we're talking about...
I breezed
about,
over it once. You said there's kind of suits against almost all the justice systems and things.
Right. Well, we're going in right now.
They just ignored you?
Right. Well, we have one case that we're doing against in a state level against the governor and the legislators. It's concerning the gun issue. And... Mm-hmm. You know, we just went in for an appeal. Not an appeal. We moved it. It's a federal case. We took it into the federal court, okay, and we moved it over to a panel for a reconsideration under what's called Rule 35, okay? Mm-hmm. So we'll use their rules to do it. We'll acknowledge the fact that this is the rules, and we'll work with them. That's good. It's sensible. It's logical. It works in common law. And so you move it over into a panel for another decision. Okay, that's where we're at with that case. And if we fail there, we'll then move it into the appellate courts. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, we have another case we're getting ready to file. Okay. Well, we have another case we filed that's been open for over a year and a half now, which is really a depository for us, a place to deposit all of our paperwork as a grand jury. So that we're under the auspices of the court. They don't send the papers back. They keep telling us to stop. We keep sending them anyway. We haven't sent one in a while, but we'll be sending some soon. We're opening another case, which is suing the judiciary itself for robbing the people of their courts of justice. They have concealed courts of records. You cannot get in there with, you know, if you want to go in, it's called a civil case. And if they're going to come out after you for something, you know, they're going to call that a criminal case. Well, the Supreme Court has ruled that criminal cases and civil cases, they don't have any authority. They're not courts of law. They don't have any true authority. It's a court of fiction. They're both statutory, so they both operate under equity. And I just wrote a paper recently concerning that issue, and I've discovered some really fascinating wording inside of their own rules concerning it seems to be very well hidden, but it's very well there. You know, you can't deny it's there. And they're really identifying the two different courts. One of them is called a common law court, which they actually used the words, if I recall, they used it natural law inside the wording. And and you can see the game they played on how they've taken court, what we think is courts of record or common law courts, and they've placed it into equity, because if there's any statutes controlling that court, you're in an equity court, okay? Yeah. And in a common law court, there are no statutes controlling it, and that's the key. So these are the big arguments. This is the war game here, you know, winning these cases, winning the case that we're getting ready to file against the judiciary is the key to getting justice back into the court. There's no one else out there that I know of doing this. And And anybody who's trying to get justice in the court or get things going, they use lawyers, and that they're controlled to some degree. You know, they'll get a scolding inside of by the judge in the back room if they do something wrong or bring up issues that the judge doesn't want. You know, he doesn't want to be in jeopardy. So if they start to bring something up that he's not happy with, he'll call for them to go into the chambers, and he'll let them know, we're not going to have this in this court. We're not going to talk about this and that and so on and so forth. And the threat ultimately, whether they say it or not, is the loss of their license, what they call a license anyway, the bar license, I guess it's called. Yeah. And so that's a problem for lawyers. I'd find this very depressing as a lawyer. I'm not a lawyer, so I don't get called into the back room, so to speak, and they're not going to discuss those kind of things with me. But this is what we're up against, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So criminal courts are not courts of record. They're not courts of justice. Civil courts are not courts of record. They're not courts of justice. Clear. The United States Supreme Court has said that already.
Yeah.
See, the frustration that I have, okay, and is the fact that the United States Supreme Court, they understand all of this. They understand jurisdiction, okay? They know there's a fraud going on. They know they've given the authority to the Supreme Court. It's, you know, to the, not necessarily, well, to the Supreme Court, which really handed it down to the judiciary as a whole, I guess, to work out the rules of the court. And to play with the language that they play in there. On a civil level, it's USC 28. And USC 28 is the judiciary rules and the process and the rules of civil procedure is in there. And the rules of evidence is in there. And numerous other things. But really, USC 28 is the controlling factor of all the U.S. titles. In other words, it gives procedure and process inside USC 28 for all of the other titled courts, okay, and half of these courts are administrative courts only. They'll only get a hearing in the federal courts if they go through the administrative process first. Matter of fact, I just recently had a judge talk about that in one of the papers I'm writing, saying that we failed to go through the administrative process first. Well, only slaves do that. We the people don't do that. And if you word it right and you get everything and you get your you know what you need as far as your law, which is they've written it, and you can use a lot of things they use on the statutes, but also U.S. Supreme Court rulings, and you could build a very strong case showing the fact that you don't need to do that. Okay, we go right straight in. And open up a court of record, and the decision of that court is final. Problem is, opening up that court of record, that's been the battle. Thornton has battled it, and I don't think, he may think he's opened them up, but he really hasn't. He won in cases when they throw you out. We've won in cases where we've been thrown out, but we haven't won on record. They don't want you to win on record. They will get rid of you if they... feel that you're putting them into too much jeopardy, and they definitely don't want a win on the record, so they'll force the other side to work a deal out and settle the matter and get it out of this court. So that's the only way you're going to win in those cases. But he's never really opened a court of record. We have opened up courts of record, and we've really never opened up a court of record as far as them acknowledging it. We have opened it up, but they haven't acknowledged it. And the same thing with Thornton. They haven't acknowledged his. And I don't know of anyone that has done that and it's been acknowledged. Again, your win will be getting out of the court and making some kind of a deal. And
you said court of record is a common law court.
A court of record is a common... A court of record means that there's a jury there. Okay? Untainted.
I thought... See, I'm new at all this, and I need a lot to learn. I thought a court of record was a state court. They had a stenographer.
No. Well, that's what they'll. That's what you know. What some lawyer, a lot of lawyers believe that they think exactly what that means. They need to go do some word studies, go into Black's Law, and start to discover what a court of record actually is. They haven't done that. When they do, they'll see it. Lawyers should see it very quickly if they haven't been taught that and they come to realize that what is this and go search it out, they'll discover exactly what it is. They're trained well enough to be able to do that if they research. My opinion, most lawyers are lazy. They'll use form things. They'll use older cases. They'll just run it through. A lot of them are in there just for the money. You file the papers and move on. But they're lazy as far as really, most lawyers anyway, are lazy as far as really learning and researching on their own. They rely on the research and the works of others, okay? And then they use that and... What's that? Oh, that's my phone. That's weird. All right, anyway, they'll use that. Huh? No. Some kind of emergency alert? Are you getting the emergency alert, Gerard? Amber alert?
No, that's on your phone.
Yeah.
It's probably John. They probably got John Durash on Amber alert.
Yeah, I've been abducted. Anyway, so trying to think where I was. As far as lawyers not doing their homework, I think they look, in the process, they become greedy. And again, I'm not talking about all lawyers, but most lawyers. They become greedy, I think, and it's just a matter of money. I see it all the time.
Thing I heard is said that lawyers for the most part, don't even know the law. They know procedure. And for another part, they've taken a vow to the to the bar. I mean, their loyalty is to the bar, not the people who hire them.
Well, they're under the threat of losing their bar license if they get out of line. That's probably a true thing. That is a true thing. I know that.
I heard they swear an oath to the bar.
I don't know that they do that. I've heard that too, but I haven't seen anything of that nature. That they actually have taken some kind of an oath to the bar.
Well, we've asked Brent that. Brent said he never took an oath, and he was a bar lawyer for a while, right?
Well, that's true, yeah.
Right? So he was a bar lawyer. They didn't make him take an oath. But, you know, state to state, things could be different. I mean, it doesn't mean that nobody takes an oath. I don't know.
Whether it's an oath or a swear of allegiance, well, I guess that's probably the same thing. Some type of thing of that where they're... Yeah, they for their loyalty to the bar is what I heard. However, it's phrased.
I don't know. Brent's operated in.
But you hear
court.
A lot of things that aren't true. You know, everybody.
Yeah.
Says they
right.
Know
well,
the
you
truth.
See, that's the problem. That's the problem. You see, I learned in the beginning the way you're learning right now, and you're reading these things, and you're looking to UCC. You're going to learn about the man on the land thing, and all these different strange things, and look at, they're right in many ways, and they're correct. And in some areas they're way off, but nevertheless they are correct in a lot of ways. The problem is you're not going to win any battles using the strategy that they're offering. You're only going to piss the judge off, and they're going to be looking to do something with you. And if they can get a psych evaluation on you, they'll push you for that. And it's just not worth the hassle. But again, like I said, you can move these things.
Well, I said this book, I didn't do it any justice, but I said you should get a copy of that and read it, and then it explained a lot better than I did. He's not talking about going in there and doing what you're thinking I'm saying. It's like you said, go in there and act, dumb. It's like you just say, I don't understand this. Would you explain that to me?
Yeah, but again,
you kind of box them into a trap with their jurisdiction, and you don't box them into a corner where they've got to, put you in the psychologist or a psychiatrist.
It's a strategy
you go in there real innocent-like.
It's a strategy that they're aware of, okay? And Gerard said, they're going to teach these judges, especially on the town level, but they're going to teach these judges how to deal with this and to look for key words and knowing who they're dealing with and to start working, getting in ahead of you to shut you down.
One of the first things they told us, they said, when the judge says, do you understand, don't say you understand, because that really means do you stand under our jurisdiction? So everybody goes, no, I don't understand. So what they did was they turned that around. They said, oh, well, you must be mentally ill if you don't understand. You're confused. We need a mental evaluation. See, they turned it around. And so, don't say you understand. You could say, yes, I understand. I don't acknowledge your jurisdiction. You have to be slick on your feet. And, you know, everybody accepts the fact, you know, right away we give them too much credibility. They say, oh, if you file a paper in their court, you fall under their jurisdiction. Let me tell you what, we should fight our cases the same way. when we fill paperwork out and we open up a court of record, like John says, we put it right up front. We put it all in the footnotes. And the time for them to object to that jurisdiction is when we put the paperwork in. And the fact that they answer us under what we filed, that means they're in our jurisdiction, and that's how we should play it. No. Yeah. If you didn't want common law, you shouldn't have answered us. You should have objected and said, no, we want this to be equity. But they'll never do that. You know why? Because they can't argue jurisdiction, because they'll have to admit that they want you in admiralty. But, you know,
that's
John, that
why you could move it into federal court if it's a serious matter and stick with one focus only. They're not giving you, you're not in a court where you can get due process. They don't have jurisdiction. That's all you have to argue, nothing else, okay? Yeah. And you can win on that, and I don't think many federal judges are going to put themselves in jeopardy over this. You know, they may look at this as you come in and evaluate, you know, to see who you are, what you say, how you couch your words and your paperwork, and how you might even answer in court if you even go into the court. But they may do something wrong if they think that you have no clue on what the next step for you to do if they were to rule against you. So maybe under that kind of a situation, they might rule against you. But, you know, and again, they got to worry about the appeal on a case like that. It's just not worth it for them on those that kind of a case. So you can win, I think, pretty simply in a federal court, of course, but you got to keep it simple. I'll tell you, if there's anything I learned, you put too many words in there, too many things and too many issues. You muddy the water. There's all kinds of things that they can attack you on, and it becomes a nightmare, okay, trying to now, you know, use your strategies to win your case. Keep it simple. They don't have jurisdiction. That's it. And use stupid words that they may have said claiming they have jurisdiction against them, and they got to now defend those words. They're not going to win. They probably will just fault. Well, no, they'll probably send some stupid paperwork. But again, you keep it simple. They may expound on something and take it, you know, and put a lot of words and a lot of things and stuff in there just to muddle up the water, so to speak. You got to stay very focused and simple. I'm only here for one reason. They don't have challenge jurisdiction. They haven't shown on the paper that they've got jurisdiction. Therefore, let them define it. Let's see if you're going to rule that they have jurisdiction.
Now I know this information's on your course. I'll get started on that pretty quick here in the next couple of days. Study that up and...
Yeah, it's going to be very in-depth. We're going to get very in-depth towards the end of this course where we get into paperwork. Okay, because... And then what we'll probably do is whatever forms we'll talk about and papers we'll talk about... We'll give a link on our website where you can download those papers and use them, you know, as an example. So it becomes a form for yourself to use. But we're going to create a form. I've got a lot of good ideas. I've read a lot of different things on how to, you know, maybe word a different kind of a form to be offered to the clerk instead of their forms that they use for the statutory courts. We're going into a court of record, so we'll see. We're going to try that out. We'll see how that works. You know?
Okay. Well, I'll let you get to the next queue there. Someone else waiting to talk. So, hey, thanks for the time.
Thank you.
Hey, John. I don't think we've. Yeah, go ahead.
Going back to those little pocketbooks, David Robinson in Maine has been selling those. He sells a number of them on Amazon. If you look at the front cover on at least three of them, they're identical to our second edition of the Common Law Handbook.
Uh-huh.
One of them, UCC Connection, so on. Second's a Meet Your Straw Man. The third one is called the Common Law Handbook for Jurors, Sheriffs, Bailiffs, and Justices. But it has a different ISBN number than ours.
Right. Yeah, he's plagiarized our work on that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The way he got a different ISBN, he just made it a different size than ours, and they gave him a different ISBN. So he made it bigger, and he charged a few more dollars. But that's word for word our book, pretty much, I believe.
Yeah, I think so.
But anyway.
Yeah, they show a few pages on the UCC connection, how to free yourself from legal tyranny. And he goes, he's got things. Let's see, this article has really filled in the voids that kept me from fully understanding things. I don't recognize anything in here. This is not my writing or our writing here and there. But that one book, the handbook, is ours, which he plagiarized and went and got an ISPN number and is selling it for $5 a piece.
Yep.
We should sue him for, what do you call it, to get some of that profit, huh?
Yeah, why not?
Yeah, but I doubt he's really sold that many.
Be interesting to know.
Yeah.
Anyway.
All right, anyway. I see Brent is here. If you want to move over to Brent and then come back, what do you want to do, Gerard?
Yeah, it's getting... We should probably get Brent out of the way because give him some time. And
yeah, let's get Brent out of the way.
Let him say his
question for him, too.
Oh, yeah, that's right. We'll start off with that question. That
right.
Brent, are you here?
Yes.
Okay, we're going to move over to you then.
Okay.
I'm going to introduce Brent. It's Brent Winters, the author of The Excellence of the Common Law. His website is commonlawyer.com. Brent, you got the mic. Well, before you go onto the mic, Jen, why don't you ask the question that came in for him?
Okay. Yes. What, if any, difference is there between a lawyer and an attorney?
Okay. That's a good question. Good questions are questions I've got something to say about. A lawyer is like a sawyer. A sawyer is an old word for a man that operates a sawmill. We used to have a sawyer at home. His name was Cornwell. And I used to go watch him. He had a big round blade. And he would sit with a little attachment that he would stick on each one of those tooths of the blade. And he would crank it like a old telephone, had a little crank on it, and it would sharpen the blade, and then it had another attachment on it that would allow him to set the tooth of the blade. He could bend it just a little bit. And he would bend that blade so that he could manipulate it, or it would cut the way he wanted it to cut. And a lawyer is like that. Sawyer, lawyer, the ER is the what they call the suffix of agency. For example, the old suffix of agency, John the Baptist. The T-I-S-T was the suffix of agency. That means we'd say today he was a baptizer, John the Baptizer. Well, that's what a lawyer or a sawyer is. He's a man who he makes the saw cut. He tries to make it cut the way that he wants it to cut. That's what a lawyer does. A lawyer is a person who knows the law. He's not a person that is licensed in any jurisdiction necessarily to represent other people, but he's a person that knows the law. Now, every attorney who is licensed, that's a different word, every attorney should be a good lawyer. He should know the law. But a lawyer is like a sawyer. A sawyer is a man that can make the saw cut just like he wants it to cut. The lawyer is a man that ought to be learned enough in the law that he can make it cut the right way. Because law can be used unlawfully. Law can be, as Paul the Apostle says, the law is good, speaking of the law of God. He said the law is good as long as a man uses it lawfully. To use the law unlawfully is called legalism, by the way. Legalism. Legalism is using the law unlawfully. Working the system, not for the sake of what is right, but for the sake of getting what you can out of it. If you want to see good examples of that, just go to the Gospel records and read the book of Acts, and really even read the epistles. All of the New Testament is a treatise against false religion, law, and government, and the prototype is Judaism, Talmudism. And you'll see there that Jesus Christ castigates the Judaics of his day the leaders of Babylonian Judaism, because they have they use the law of God unlawfully. He said to them, "You make the law of God void by your regulations." Boy, is that timely. You make the law void by your regulations. That's what the IRS does. That's what all the administrative agencies do. They hire lawyers to get around the law. They say it just that way. Well, let's get some lawyers in here. And like Roosevelt said to a pack of lawyers one time, he said, I want you lawyers to figure out a way I can get around the Constitution. And they came up with this idea about packing the court. That's called legalism. So a lawyer is one that ought to know the law well enough to make it cut the way he wants it to. The way that is right, I should say, is a better way of saying it. He may want it to cut the wrong way. Now, an attorney, by contrast, is a little different. The word attorney is an old Anglo-French word. You know, the Normans invaded England on the 14th of October, the year 1066. And when they invaded, they brought with them the French tongue. Well, their version of it. They had conquered the coast of France 160 years before. They were from Norway. They were Northmen. They conquered the coast of France, then they invaded England. But while they were there 150 years, they picked up the French tongue, and it's called a bastardized form of the French tongue called Norman French. And Norman French is now the language of our, well, not all of it. A lot of the words in our law, our common law, are Norman French words because of the French language was the only language used in government and in, even in the church, the Norman French language, from 1066 till about the year, well, to the middle of the 14th century. And then English was returned to the to Parliament and to the courts. Anglo-Saxon, they called it at that time. So the word attorney is a French Norman word that means agent. Agent. What is an agent? An agent's a man that has received authority from another person, which the law calls a principal. You have insurance agents. They act under the authority that's been delegated to them by another person. FBI agents are folks that are called agents because supposedly they have authority to do what they do. Anyone that has authority from another, a scope of authority to do something, no matter what you call him, he's an agent. He is an attorney. That's why we have in our law what we call power of attorney. It's a piece of paper that one fellow gives to another fellow that by words expresses a grant of a certain authority. You have authority when you sell a piece of real estate, you hire a real estate agent. Well, that's an attorney. In the French, Norman French tongue, that's called attorney. An agent is someone who has a scope of authority to deal with another person to sell your house, for example, a real estate agent. Well, then, coming back to the word attorney, it's one of those words. There are many French Norman words in our courts today that stuck. One well-known word is petition. Petition. That's a Norman French word. Parliament. Parley. That's a Norman French word. That's why the Parliament is called the Parliament. The Normans got here and they called it by a French word. Before that, among the Anglo-Saxons, it was called the Witten Gemot. Gemot means meeting, and Witten means white beard or white. The old men, the meeting of the old men, the elders, the aldermen, as they say in, for example, in Chicago, they're called aldermen. That's all from Anglo-Saxon. But the word attorney is a Norman French word. Attorney is an agent. Power of attorney. We still use the word that way. What is an agent? An agent is a fiduciary. That means his relationship with the principal is a fiduciary relationship. It's a contract relationship, but it's a special kind of a contract relationship where the responsibility is great. Very sensitive. The words are from the New York Court of Appeals, 20-something. The court said, that's the Supreme, the Court of Last Resort in New York. Famous case. So famous I can't remember the name of it, but I remember what was said in that case. Famous quote. See if I can remember it. the agency, the law of agency, calls for something, calls for morals more sensitive than the common run-of-the-mill morals of the marketplace. It calls for a, let me think of another phrase they use, agency, that's attorney. It calls for a, oh, an honor, here it is, an honor the most sensitive. That's what an attorney is, a lawyer who is an attorney who practices law. Attorney at law, we don't just say attorney, really the name is attorney at law. Again, that's an old Norman French way of saying it, like master at arms. Funny use of the word at to us today, but it's a very important use. Attorney at law means that the attorney at common law, the common law lawyer, and that all lawyers in America are common law lawyers, whether they understand it or not. That's what we are. We're a common law country. And the attorney at law is called at law because that's short for at the service of the law. He is, this is our history. That's why we say attorney at law in England, and they had attorneys at law. They also called them barristers at law. Barristers at law, that means at the service of the law. At the service of the law. That brings up another point. This is, I get a lot out of these discussions. Just listen to you folk talk, because I begin to more and more grasp, because I live in a bubble over here by myself on the side of a hill in a basement. I don't go anywhere. I just read and write. So I need this kind of interaction if I can get it. But I don't want to know what people are thinking. And there's no way people can really understand what goes on the inside of all this lawyer business if you're not a lawyer. It is, without question, always has been, a fraternal group. Doesn't mean it's a fraternal organization, but it is a fraternal group because attorneys. Attorneys are lawyers too, but those folks, those lawyers, those attorneys, they have a commonness among them. They've all learned the same thing. They've all gone through the same grueling experience of law school, and they've all gone through the same grueling experience of the bar exam. They all go through the same grueling experience of being abused by judges who are too haughty for their own britches. So there is a fraternal. It's, by the way, that fraternity has been eroded a lot in the last 10, 15 years, 20 years, because of the presence of the female in the courts. That really didn't come on until, I should say, 30 years ago. It began to come on pretty strong. Before that, it didn't amount to much. Law schools now have more girls in them than boys, and that has destroyed the fraternal feeling that men have had. Why? Well, men have a lot in common that they don't have in common with the female. So now that the female's here, all of that has gone away quick. By the way, chivalry in the courts has gone away. Honor, respect, all because of that. I'm not stating an opinion. It's just fact. I go to court. I see it. That fraternity is slowly being destroyed. I want to make one other mention, though. And judges on the bench are females and not males. That's just fact. That changes everything. It changes the whole dynamic. Absolutely, without question. The question is it good or bad? Well, I'm not answering that question. I'm just stating the fact of the matter. You can go observe it for yourself and see. But I will say that the rules of our courts arose from chivalry. And chivalry had to do with trial by battle. In America, we called it the duel. And all that we do, right, from service of process right on through, are the rules of chivalry applied not to trial by battle, but to battle by trial. And those are going away too, by the way. There is not the same honor. Men can't battle. They look at the female different, and the female looks at them different. To ignore that is buffoonery. It's silliness to say that there's no difference. Of course there is. But a while ago it was said that lawyers, I wrote some of it down, it's worth talking about. I'm glad that this caller brought it up, because as I said, there's no way somebody on the outside could know what goes on the inside of this this fraternal feeling that lawyers have had for centuries. And by the way, that fraternal feeling they have is arose out of history, because in England the common lawyer arose because the Norman French was being spoken in the courts. There are only 6,000 Anglo-Normans or Norman French in England. Probably a million Anglo-Saxons and Anglo-Danes. And those Anglo-Saxons and Anglo-Danes spoke the same tongue. It was a Germanic form of speech called Anglo-Saxon. They could not go into court. By far and away, the most Englishmen in those days couldn't get a hearing in court because they couldn't speak Norman French. And then William the Conqueror took the Roman priests and put them in place and told them to use the common law. Well, they began to insert the Roman canon law in what they were doing, and that is absolutely contrary to the common law. And so there was confusion. So the English-speaking people, some of them, some poor widow would have a problem, would need to go into court. The judges didn't understand Anglo-Saxon. So somebody who had learned both languages would be kind enough to go into court, speak for the poor widow or the child or the crippled man or whatever it was. And because he knew both languages, he got to doing it more and more. And then if people had money, they began to pay those kind of folk that knew both languages a little bit to do it. And that's how the common lawyer arose. There weren't any common lawyers before then. The common lawyer arose because of the differences in language. The courts operated in one language, and 98% of the people in England didn't speak that language. It was that simple. So this class of men began to arise. And then they saw that the Roman priest, that's what William appointed to the courts, and he got rid of the churchmen from England, and the other people, the sheriffs that administered the courts, and they got to notice, and they were inserting this law of the city, the canon law of Rome, which is the code, the Roman code of the Roman Empire, adjusted to an ecclesiastic organization, the church at Rome. And so they said, we've got to stop this. We're going to lose all our rights. We're going to lose the jury. We're going to lose due process, because those are creatures of our common law that don't exist in the rest of the world under the code of Rome, the code of Justinian, the canon law. And so they begin to secretly form societies, these men that could speak Anglo-Saxon and Norman French. And they said, not only that, Rome has control of the only education in the country of higher education, Oxford University. We've got to form our own way to train lawyers about our common law, our law of the land. They didn't call it common law then. They called it the laws of Edward the Confessor. They called it the law of the land. They called it, which is the same thing as saying due process. And they begin to form these organizations that would secretly, they could learn the procedure of our common law. Our common law is a law of procedure. It is not a law of substance. Due process is our common law. Due process isn't part of our common law. That's what it is. Because our common law is not result-oriented. It's process-oriented. Our common law says stick to the process, stick to the course of our common law. The result will take care of itself. The law of the city, the canon law, the civil law, the code of Rome is just the opposite. It's result-oriented. It doesn't make any difference what the process is. This is the result we have to achieve. Boy, once you get there, process doesn't matter. The means or the ends justify the means. That's why torture. It's common in South America. Torture is just part of this system. Go to the New Testament. You see the same thing in all the words of the Roman Greek city-states are there about torture. Read the book of Acts. Read all about torture. It has all the legal words in there that they use and get information out of people, and scourging people, putting them on the rack, all that kind of stuff. Well, our common law is about procedure, and it forbids those kind of things. And just a minute while I gather my thoughts. I get going in one direction, then I distract myself. I don't want to get too far afield from our subject. Of course, the Anglo-Saxons formed these institutions of learning. They began to call them inns of court. Inns of court. And there were four inns of court that they formed to train common law lawyers, practitioners of our common law. Now, when our country started, just to drop a footnote, there were about 100 graduates of the Inns of Court from England that were part of the beginning of our country. About 100. Quite a few, frankly, in our colonies. The Inns of Court were private organizations. They had no government funding. Oxford University was under government charter and controlled by the government. And it was a tool of Rome. All the universities of Europe always have been and were founded by the Roman See, beginning at Bologna, Italy. Bologna, I just like to say Bologna. When I was a kid, it looked like Bologna. It was printed, so that's what I called it. Oscar Meyer had Bologna. I had a lot of Bologna when I was growing up. It was a staple in my house. I still like it, but I don't eat it. Because I grew up knowing what was in Bologna. We raised hogs, and I knew what went into Bologna. You don't want to eat that stuff. Everything, the eyeballs and the bones go in there. They only use the old boar hogs that are old and tough to make bologna. That's why it stinks so much. A lot of fat, too. But all the universities begin. That's why we say, no matter how thin you slice it, it's still bologna. That came from the university town, the first university on our planet, Rome, established at Bologna, Italy, to supplant the Bible with the Code of Justinian. The Roman code, and the story of the common lawyer, that's what they called them in England. They called themselves common lawyers to distinguish themselves from the civil lawyers. Civil is a law that means city. Common law is the law of the land. And the Roman civil law, which governs almost every country in the world today by the Code of Justinian in its various forms, is called the law of the city. And this battle between the common law, the common lawyer, and the civilian, that's the law of the city countries all over the world call their lawyers civilians. And in England, in centuries past, lawyers of the common law were called commoners. Commoners versus civilians, that's what they were called. The commoner was handmaiden. The common lawyer was handmaiden, or at the service of the law. And the highest level of learning of the common lawyer was called the barrister, and he was called a sergeant at law. Sergeant at law. That means he was the servant. That's an old word that means servant of law. And the law of the city lawyers, which were the Roman priests in that day in England, they were called the servants of the Pope. And therein lies the difference between the two systems. And that's why we say in America, for instance, that we are a government of law, not a government of men. Government of men, what does that mean? That means some man tells you what to do. Some emperor, such as the Pope, tells you what to do. He is the government. That's the divine right of kings. That's a government of men. A man or a combination of men exerting a single will, like a legislature. That's a government of men. A government of law, by distinction, is a government of the will of the supreme judge of all the world, the sovereign, God himself, the maker of all things. That's why we say law, not men. It has nothing to do with men. It has everything to do with deity. The deity, not any deity. There are a lot of them. This is the maker of heaven and earth and all that in them is. And it is for that reason, of course, that William Blackstone, in his first volume of his commentaries on the laws of England, our common law, says there are only two revelations, two revealings of law. There is the law unwritten in the nature of things. We call that our common law, meant to be observed and ruled on, like we do in our courts. And then there is the laws of nature of our Declaration of 76, lex non scripta, law not written. And then Blackstone says there is the law written, the Bible. Those are the two volumes, one written, the other unwritten, of the laws of England, our common law. Those are the foundations. Over and over, Justice Story said that's the same thing on our Supreme Court, Justice of our Supreme Court. Sir William Fortescue said the same thing in the 14th century. Littleton said the same thing in the 12th century. It's been said by many judges since, it's just an observation that our law of the land comes in two volumes. It's really something that we here in America and our organic documents of law recognize, Congress recognizes them, our Declaration of 76 declares the sources, the foundation of all of our law. And anything that is inconsonant in our law, anything inconsonant with these two volumes is not our law. I don't care what the government says, and I don't care how much force they bring to bear, how many people they jail, how many people they kill. They do not change the fact of the two volumes of our law, the laws of nature, unwritten in the nature of things, are common law. Unwritten, meant to be observed and applied. And the laws of nature is God written in the Bible. And William Blackstone makes the point, of course, as the Reformers did, that the Bible is the final rule for man in all matters of life, even the common law. Anything of in our common law that's contrary to the Bible or is seen to be contrary, it's not part of our common law, never was. Our common law is consonant with that second volume because the author of both volumes is the same lawgiver, the maker of heaven and earth and all that in them is. And anything contrary to that is not law at all. Of course, we say that as a matter of our Constitution. Our Constitution is a brief of common law government. It says that it is, Article 6, the law of the land, lifting that phrase from Magna Carta. It is the law of the land. What is the law of the land? The law of the land is due process. And by the way, the difference is, I'm a lawyer, yeah, I'm an attorney. I've taken seven oaths in my life, seven times, to support and defend the Constitution of the United States against enemies foreign. That means willingness to take up arms and enemies domestic. That means willingness to serve on the jury or to bring suit if I have to. And that's the duty of every American, whether they take that oath or not, by the way. An oath does not create any new duties. An oath only strengthens the duty you already have as an American. You have that duty. I have that duty, but I've taken it seven times. And I've taken it twice as a lawyer and five times as a military man. I kept getting out and going back in. So they'd make me swear again. I took it as a lawyer when I became a lawyer, and I took it as when I briefly served for 1 month as a county prosecutor in a small rural county. And the oath is always substantially the same, and because lawyers are officers of the court, they're not paid to be officers of the court. Everybody else is. They aren't. Judges are, and all the other people in the court are paid. The lawyers aren't. The court doesn't pay the lawyer, but he is an officer of the court. Therefore, the Constitution of the United States says he has to take that oath to support and defend the Constitution. I just discovered recently that there was a sheriff's department, I won't say where, but they have me on a list. Me, on a list. As a dangerous man. And the word that they apply to me to prove how dangerous I am, he is a constitutionalist. I learned that just recently, within the last week. A constitutionalist? Every lawyer in America is an officer of some court, and every lawyer, by the terms of our Constitution, to be a lawyer, to represent other people, has to take that oath to support and defend the Constitution. And then they tell us, are telling me, I'm dangerous. I took an oath to support and defend the Constitution, therefore, I'm a constitutionalist. And you know, those guys are nuts. They're dangerous. That's the wacky world in which we live. And the only way to defeat that kind of wacky, silly, childish madness, and destructive, it'd be funny if it wasn't so destructive, is to use the right words. Do not even think about using words that are politically correct. Don't even go there. Use the right word. Yeah, you're a constitutionalist. I'm a constitutionalist. If you aren't, you're not an American. Wake up and smell the coffee, boys and girls. Our Constitution is the supreme law of the land, the way things ought to be done. Due process. Well, every lawyer takes an oath to law. We do not take an oath in America. No, I've never met a lawyer. I haven't. I've never met a lawyer who ever took an oath to the Queen of England. I've never met a lawyer, and I haven't, who's ever taken an oath to the Bar Association I don't even belong to a bar association. I have never belonged to a bar association because I don't agree with their policies in most cases. Now, there are some states where you, if you practice law, you have to belong. That's not true where I've practiced. So I don't belong. But I'm glad that these things are brought up, and I'm glad that this fellow, this man that called in mentioned it. He really wants to know. He's trying to get to the bottom of it. He's searching it out. That's why people listen to these presentations. That's why I listen, so I can learn something, maybe hear something new, know what's going on out there on the so-called street. It's very helpful. So I just say that in passing because I hear it a lot. Now, after we get done with our evidence class, John, Gerard, I was asked to do this. What's my idea? I've got a list. I'm building it. I call it the list of patriot mythology, things that people say that become believed that are not true. And as that one fellow said, Josh Billings, they say this on the radio station where they play, where they run my stuff every day. Josh Billings, they quote him, it isn't the things that men don't know that hurt them. It is the things that, Gerard, you said this the other day, a couple of weeks ago. It's the things that they think they know that just ain't so. That's what hurts them. We're all in that position to varying degrees. That's why we're trying to learn. And we're constantly trying to keep our ears open and listen. Well, John and Gerard, both of you, or one of you who are there, I don't know how long I've been talking. I did want to say something about the Constitution because I'm going through it. But if you let me do that just a little bit, just so we can make some progress every week, I'd like to do that. Is that all right? They're probably muted out by now. So if, when they come back, they can tell me in the meantime. I want to pick up where I left off as we tool through our Constitution of the United States, if I can find it here. I think I was in that part of our Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, if I'm not mistaken, that talks about, yeah, here it is. I think I'm up about page 100 and something here. I'm kind of just going through some of my comments. That part where it talks about veto and how things become law. And there was a, section here where we're talking about the pocket veto. And what I remember about it is the reason there is a pocket veto, it allows the President of the United States to stick the bill that Congress sends to him to sign, stick it in his pocket, so to speak, as it were. And if he sticks it in his pocket, that means lays it on his desk or shelves it someplace or whatever he does, and doesn't do anything within 10 days, it becomes law, whether he does anything or not. And that way, gives him an out, he can let something become law without saying anything about it, because if he vetoes it, our Constitution requires that he write down, put in writing the reasons for his veto. For example, President Andy Jackson vetoed the renewal, the legislation that would have renewed the charter for the National Bank. And he vetoed it. And he used that as an opportunity to say why the National Bank is a dangerous thing. And he didn't mince any words, by the way. And he said this, but one of the things that he said that is worth repeating, and I've repeated it here often, but it bears repeating. He said, I think I'm quoting him pretty much just the way he said it. He said, when I took an oath to support and defend the Constitution of the United States, of course, that's when he became president. He said, I did not take an oath to support it and defend it as some other person understands it. He said, I took an oath to support and defend it as I understand it. Of course, it'd be silly to think anything else, but people get to thinking crazy things like that. And so he says, as I understand it, the federal government, the general government of Washington, D.C., doesn't have any business granting charters to corporations that are national banks. Of course, he had said that they were all vermin and they're destroying our country, which, of course, is true, money grubbers and getting out of control. I mean, money grubbing is part of being human, really. I mean, everybody wants to get what they can get out of a deal. But when that goes to seed, as with bankers, well, that's very bad, and that's what banks give opportunity to do. Gives opportunity for native greed, which is natural to look out for yourself, but gives it an opportunity to go to seed and to abuse others in ways that are unlawful, unconscionable. Well, our declarations, our constitutions, Article 1, Section 7, Clause 1, Section 7, Clause 2, talks about veto, as I'd said. And the reason for veto is important. Our Declaration of 76, Paragraph 4, reveals the reasons for this clause's 10-day rule and pocket veto. The Congress sends each bill that passes both houses of Congress to the President of the United States for his signature. If he disapproves of the bill, he has 10 days, not counting Sundays, to return it to the House that originated it, along with his written statement of his objections. And law calls this objection a veto, which means, in Latin, to say no. Just say no. Congress, however, can pass a law over the President's veto by a two-thirds vote of each House of those members present. Then the President can also allow a bill to become law by merely letting 10 days pass without signing it. If, however, Congress sends a bill to the President during the last 10 days of Congress's session, it will only become law if the President signs it. Because of the time problem there, the 10 days won't be around, see? Consequently, if a bill the President dislikes reaches him within the last 10 days of Congress's session, he can veto it by simply never signing it. But to ignore it in such a case is to take a chance. Congress kills the bill only if it adjourns within 10 days. Tradition calls this a pocket veto. By the pocket veto, the President can avoid revealing what he thinks of the bill, and that may help him politically. That's what that boils down to. But excluding Sundays from days countable toward the 10 days required for Congress's override of the President's failure to sign its bills, this clause provides implicit yet clear evidence of the framers' intent. Sundays are excluded from the processes of law. Let me repeat that. Sundays, traditionally in America, from our beginning, are excluded from the processes of law because our common law has incorporated the practice from Christianity. That's why. And I'm quoting the case story, V. Eliot, from the year 1827 in the state of New York, makes that point, holding that the first day of the week is holy. The old English word holy means separated out from the other 6 days for celebration of the resurrection of Jesus Christ. That's part of our history. People say that our founders weren't Christians, many of them. They cite especially Ben Franklin, John Adams, Tom Paine, George Washington, and all of their activities in secret societies and the Masons and all this is true. But we must keep in mind that there were many that were, many, many, many. And politicians are always political hacks. What does that mean? That means they learn how to repeat back to people, put in words what people are thinking. Because if you can put in words what people are thinking, they'll love you for it. And they'll vote you into office. And those fellows I mentioned, Washington, Franklin, Adams, and Paine was a rank hater of the Bible and Christianity. But he wasn't stupid. When he wrote Common Sense, it was a treatise of the Old Testament, from the Old Testament, proving why from the Older Testament of the Bible and the Newer Testament a little, why we don't need a king. He knew that was the only thing Americans would accept or understand. Why? Because we, at that time, without question, were a Christian nation, regardless of what the political people were saying. And that's why, of course, this is put in our Constitution of the United States, because legal process, trial by battle, battle by trial, and all the processes that go with it never did occur on Sunday, weren't allowed on Sunday. Duels weren't allowed on Sunday in the old days in England, battle or trial by battle, because Sunday is a special day according to the sensibilities of the Christian religion. And I know that it came out of the sun. Sunday came from the days of Constantine and the worship of the sun. But it was adopted, and that has been our culture. For whether it's right or wrong is another question. But it has to do with our Christian sensibilities. Well, that's enough words from me today. Whatever I say and have said here is not necessarily the opinion of National Liberty Alliance, but is my opinion, and no one else's. But as always, I really enjoy the time that the leaders of National Liberty Alliance give me to say a few words. Thank you, men. And back to you, Gerard, if you're there. Assume you are.
Yes, I am.
Yeah.
Good.
Gerard, we've got Crystal waiting with some questions.
Okay.
Do you want to take her?
Yeah. Yeah. I'll open her up and see what we got here. Well, she's not opening up. So there she goes. Crystal, are you there? Crystal. Crystal Mack. The check mark went away, but she's still...
Okay. Can you hear me?
Hello? There you go.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yep.
Go ahead, Crystal.
Yes, hi. Okay. I put the affidavit together, and they have to send me the, they have to, I'm giving them 10 days to respond. And I also sent you the papers on that. It's the IR code, and that's 6065, and where they would have to prove everything, otherwise it's not, it's their perjury themselves. So I send you that information. I also put in the foreign agent form of 1938, and they, the attorneys, they all had to be unfiled, and if they're not unfiled with the W-9, that means they are, God, what is it? I'm so tired. They have no jurisdiction. And it's all fraud and what they've been doing. So this is all the papers we sent in. They basically try to disregard. And that's when I sent all the other papers in, the other attorneys had recused themselves on my case to judge. So I put another one together again. And another, you know, a few of the people we've been working with, they submitted. And all of a sudden the attorneys... Today I was at court. The attorneys didn't even know what these forms were about. And then, oh God, I have to get this written up. About I am a living soul, and I got to send you the paperwork. Well, anyways, the other party, she read that in the court today, and the attorney didn't know what to say and what to do. And then all of a sudden he started babbling on about the 1938, the foreign agent, and it's for him to fill out. I couldn't believe that the incompetence of some of these attorneys, the games they were playing. Then when the other statement was read, the judge looked up, she basically looked at me, and because I was with the party there, and she goes, oh, it's nice to see you. And I said, likewise. And then he could not answer the questions. Then all of a sudden, I didn't think she was sure what was being read to her, so she pulled out her book and she was looking. She goes, I have to get back to you. I have to get back to you. She wouldn't give the party. I was would not give her the answer. But I will send put that paperwork together also, because we have to put something together because they want me out the 19th. And by the way, on the affidavits, I wrote them. There was 10 points. It was 8 points. But the last two, I wrote, I will not vacate my property. I am the sole heir, and I wrote all the other stuff on there. Because when you are in foreclosure, and I got to get the other paper, is when you abandon your house. And so what she was telling the people, because she kept us here until 5 o'clock, and my car had broken down, so I was very tired. She told the other people that were in there, I was jotting my notes down. She said, well, this is going to be a strict foreclosure, and we don't have to put the sign on there. So what's going on? The attorneys are taking the people's property. And they want the people out the house by such and such a day. I think this person has to be out by April 2nd. So she told the attorney, she goes, so you don't have to put the sign up or nothing. And we'll, you know, and she tells people, well, I'm going to give you 4 months, and that's plenty of time, so get your act together and be out that house. She goes, you got from now until April 2nd to be out the house. And we just looked at each other like, oh, my God. It's going to be strict foreclosure, and it's going to be signed over to the attorneys and the so-called fake bank. And so that's what they were trying to pull with me back in November 5th. And so on my paperwork today, I made sure I had it notarized and everything. And I did an form, my affidavit, and I said, I will not leave or abandon my home. And they have to answer the other seven questions prior to that. So I gave them 10 days. So today is the 2nd. So they have to answer by the 12th. And that's basically it. And also, before I forget, there is going to be a big meeting in Hartford, Connecticut. And it's about the courts, attorneys, it's about the judicial system. And I believe it's supposed to be asked. Wait a minute. It's going to be up in the Capitol, and it's about the, you know, the ruling and the unfairness about the grievance, about the illegal foreclosures, about the DCS, about the children that are being taken from their parents. It's quite a few issues. So I believe it's going to be, it's on the website. And it's called, wait a minute, the interest of the registration should be visited. ConnecticutBar.org. Rules of law. Or there's a number to call on there. It's CBA, member service. And it's 844-469-2212.
Now that's for this meeting.
This is going to be up in it's up in Hartford, Connecticut.
Okay.
Okay. So as a matter of fact,
what do you call the number for to get a place in there, or you can just show up, or what?
Yeah, you can show up, and it's called. Wait a second, because somebody texted me something. Hold on 1 second, please. I'm gonna. The person who is sponsoring it, I can. Because it's a number of things and all the corruptions that's going on in the Superior Federal and Appellate Court. And a lot of the judges, you know.
And who's sponsoring that? I mean, is this a government agency, or is this an agency, or is this the people getting together?
I guess the people are getting together.
Right. I don't understand why they're foreclosing. They're putting the house in the attorney's name and the state bank. What's that all about? What's the state bank?
That was what they are doing. Like for myself, for example, for the foreclosure, they said the bank wants to do it. Then they turned around and said, no, we're going to do a strict foreclosure. Now we're not going to put the sign up, and we want you out your house by the 19th of January. So my rebuttal to them was, you know, the proof of claim, due process, and all that. And plus, I have everything, basically my name. So I put on the paperwork that I submitted today, I will not, because I sent them some other papers, if I'm always submitting papers, but today I said, the last two, I said, I will not vacate my home or abandon my home, ever. And I had it stamped, and they have to answer the other questions, and they got 10 days to answer. If they do not answer or respond, they are in default. And what I wrote and swore to is the truth. And I want this whole thing dismissed. But this time I put all the names, the chief judge, the attorneys. So they all have to respond.
Well, you know they're not going to answer, right?
Well, we know that, yeah.
Yeah, so when they don't answer, you have to go in and file a default with the clerk.
Okay.
Or with the court. Otherwise, it doesn't mean anything, right?
Right, so I got until the 12th.
So once they default, you go in and try to do it with the clerk. She may not want to do it. She may want to do it through the judge, but you'll have to draw the paper up for the default for the judge to sign or the clerk to sign. Now, the clerk knows that you put a paper in because she stamped it, and you go in with the evidence and you say, well, look, here's when I put it in. They've defaulted, you know, they were supposed to answer, and you need to acknowledge the default, and I'm filing the default. You need to record the default in the record. So she should do it, but she may be scared to do it. She may want the judge to do it, which he can do it. He can sign it. And, I mean, technically, he has to sign it because, you know, unless somebody has a real good reason of why they defaulted, you know. I mean, he could put his 2 cents in and say, well, I'm not going to sign it because there's extenuating and mitigating circumstances or whatever. I can't imagine what he would come up with, but... You know, just make sure that you follow up on the default, though, because if you just say they have to answer by the 10th and they don't answer, you need to send out a notice of default to everybody, to all parties. You have to tell them that they've defaulted. That's a requirement, notice of default.
Okay.
You know, so and then what you do is you go right into the clerk and you get her to stamp the thing and you know, notarize the paper that says that they defaulted on such and such a date and see what happens. They're going to fight you every bit of the way, but you never know. I was able to get the clerk over here to sign a default with this company that I was fighting, and she gave me the default, and I went into the court with it before the hearing, and I said, well, it's too late. They didn't answer on time, and I got the default. He was very upset that she did that, but there wasn't anything he could do about it. I mean, he did eventually rule against me, but I never heard anything back because I think the default was more powerful than his ruling, because he ruled after she defaulted, and he didn't remove the default, and they didn't ask him to remove the default, so he had no authority. You know what I mean?
Right.
In other words, the judge can't say they're not defaulted when they don't even show up and say why they're not defaulted, because there's only two reasons. They have to prove two things. They got to prove that it was a very good reason why they didn't answer, and number two, they have to prove that had they answered, they probably would have won the case. So they have to meet those two standards to get out of a default, which they can't do, really. There's no reason they shouldn't answer something. There are a bunch of attorneys. They got all kinds of people working for them. So just be careful and make sure that you follow that default up, because, you see, these courts, what they do is they'll sit on their hands and they'll wait to see what you're going to do. And if you don't do something in a timely manner, they'll say, ah, she doesn't know what she's doing. She doesn't know the next step. And then they'll move on you, you know?
Right. But, again, because I had another case today also where somebody had falsified and tried to steal a family member's estate on this. But I'm handling that. So, but here, I got it because I had to get up and put my glasses on. Okay. All right, here it goes here. This is the Connecticut Bar Conference to address attack on the judicial. And let's see. The representative of the, and we're also, I guess the media is going to be there too. So anybody who wants to come up here, I'm just going to, it says organize on the upcoming Connecticut Conference, says they want to discuss a judicial increasing on facts and criticism. The Connecticut Bar Association is revising its ruling of law conference to address the pitfalls of these attacks and discuss what lawyers and judges can do about it. And it's Jonathan Shapiro, Bar President of the President of the Middletown Base Shapiro Law Office, says media and rules of laws of the judicial have drawn to irie of people from the political perspective. It's not accurate, Shapiro says, to put the blame for heat rhetorical soul of the foot of the President Donald Trump. Rather, he said everyone can work on ramping down the heat comment. Alrighty, okay.
I think Shapiro is a New York lawyer, isn't he? He's I've heard his name.
Right,
Shapiro.
I guess they got, well, there's a lot of Shapiros. He's from Connecticut. Shapiro said, "We, the governor by law, and the people, no one is above the law. Lawyers should be the defendant of the rule of law. We are the front line of defense and should make sure the law is followed by all people." Okay. The conference, the first one in 5 years, will be held from 8:30 to 12:30 p.m. December 6th in the Legislative Office Building in Hartford. It will feature a who's who in the world of law, medium, and political. These take part will include Connecticut Supreme Court Chief Justice Richard Robinson, at least four Connecticut appellate court judges, Secretary of State Denise Merrill, House Majority Leader Matt Ritter, House Majority Leader Thelmas, whatever how you pronounce her name, and Ashka Rampa, a former FBI agent, senior lecturer at Yale, and the CNN correspondent. About 250 people are expected to attend, but I'm sure it's going to be a lot more than that because everybody's putting it out now.
Boy, I'd like to see if they even let anybody like us get a word in edgewise on that thing with all those politicians and officials there.
Well, wait a second. Here. If anybody has anything to say, okay, she can contact me. She goes, this Alexandra, please let me know how many people you think would be coming. And also, she said, if anybody has any comments, stuff to say. Oh, God. Why is
anybody going? Yeah, she's probably going to want a list of what you're going to ask before you come, I'll bet.
No. They want, because they're the ones who are going up against them. That's why I said, let me... Hold on one second, please. Did you want her number?
Is that that number you just repeat that you just read off?
No, this is the one who's in charge of it down this area.
Yeah, read that off so that it's on the recording so we can get it off the recording. Go ahead.
Okay, hold on one second. Let me... Okay, Alexandra, her number is 203-644-6693.
203-664-6693?
Yes.
Okay, good.
And I guess, yeah, because I spoke to her this morning because I have no transportation. My vehicle broke down, so.
What day is that? What would you say, the 6th? It's coming right around the corner.
Yeah, it's going to be on Thursday. This Thursday.
Yeah, I don't know that I can make that. I mean, it would be interesting to go there, though, and be a fly on the wall, or at least be able to contribute to some kind of statement there.
Yeah.
Too bad we couldn't write some kind of paper to have her read it.
Okay, well, that's what I'm saying. You could maybe
from the Thomas Law Grand Jury.
Right.
You know, some kind of summary that we've witnessed these cases, and as far as we're concerned, they're outside the rule of law, and they're, you know what I'm saying? Maybe I'll talk to John about that. Maybe we can make a statement, and we can send it to her, and that'll be the official statement of National Liberty Alliance into this issue. I mean,
absolutely.
it would be good for us to make a statement on something like this with all the. With all the bigwigs hobnobbing together.
Well, you know what I'm going to do, because I'm sure she sleeps. I just said, I will call her first thing in the morning and, you know, let them know and that I did put this out.
Right.
Also, I got to go back to the court. I got to go back to the court tomorrow to fax these papers. So what I will do is I'm going to make more of these copies, and I'm going to get them out there, and I'm going to give it to other people so they can sit there and put it on their website and everything too, you know.
Yeah.
And we'll try to get it out there. But
you tell them if they kick you out of your house, you're going to be in the court every single day, because you're going to, that's the only place you'll be able to live is in the courthouse.
Oh, yeah. But see, my case is a lot different from everybody else's. Because I have my warranty deed. I have everything. I have life use. I have everything. It's solely mine. I even patent my land. I got
so in order for
property.
Them to foreclose on you, they have to ignore all that stuff.
Exactly. And that's
so
what
you
I
have
said.
To have a judge that's willing to sign the thing to say, warranty deed doesn't mean anything. Life statement doesn't mean anything. And you know what? They might be able to find somebody that's a big enough, excuse my French, jackass to do it.
No,
but,
I don't think so right now. As a matter of fact, that's why three of the judges recused themselves. The attorneys all took themselves off the case for me. And the funny thing today, the one who started all this, who is a retired judge, which everybody's complained about this judge, so now they scrambled the eggs and they got him. I guess he's still in the court, but like they said, he had resigned. He's no longer there. Well, guess who I ran smack into around 1 o'clock today? That same judge. And he's retired. And he's down
in the basement doing his dirty work.
Well, he was shocked. I don't even know what floor he's on, but he was shocked that he turned it in, you know. And I looked him dead in his face, and he just turned his head and just walked through the door.
Well, they don't usually like to let the judges come anywhere in contact with the people. They sneak them out the back and under the underground breezeways and causeways. They always sneak them in and out because they know they're doing dirty work and they're trying to protect them, you know?
Yeah, well, I guess this because all the mess that was happening, everybody started talking, and his name came up over and over and over again. And he's been doing the dirty work for the past 8 years, and that we know of might have been longer than that. And it's just like he brought too much notoriety to them. And all the people and everybody started writing to the judicial system, to the Bar Association, and the grievance. And another thing,
it's important to make the complaint too. It's important to put those complaints in against him because
absolutely
they don't like too many complaints because they got to keep the people quiet. You know, it's bread and circuses. If the people complain too much, you know, they got to give more bread or more circus or they got to do something. But it's important to put the complaint in.
But guess what else I found out too? I said, well, wait a second. Their oath and bond. Like I found out this one particular judge who signed up on my Social Security, he has been disbarred since 2007. He's still ruined. He's not even a judge. He has no juris number. So now they're all trying to backpedal on that one. Another thing I found out, because the best way you find out answers is when you start asking questions. I said, who's insuring them? I want their insurance. Well, I contacted the Attorney General's office last week, and I said, I would like to know who is in charge and who is liable. Doesn't the attorneys and judges have to carry insurance, liability insurance, you know? And also, because there was a case, I remember, oh, God, this was back maybe the 80s, 90s, where a judge was a probate judge, and what happened, I guess he was over all these estates, and he ended up blowing almost, I think it was like maybe $10 million of the people's estate, and then he ended up committing suicide. I said, and then we found out they wasn't bonded or whatever. I never found out the outcome of that case.
Well,
so I asked the question. So I had asked the question again. So I said, well, who is liable when a judge or an attorney is held liable? How do you get your, you know, if the people want a repercussion? So they said, oh, well, every year, once a year, the attorneys and the judges, they put in a kitty under the grievance committee. So they have to pay you out. And if they are found wrong, you know, then the grievance committee goes back after that attorney or judge and gets their money back or whatever. And I said, oh, okay. So we got to know what repercussion do we have, you know?
Well, I know in New York they say, well, they're covered, the state covers them. They're under the auspices of the state. Which means that's what's kind of illegal because they're supposed to have their own surety bond. It's supposed to be their own money.
Security,
it's supposed
right.
to be a deterrent for them. And, of course, if the state's going to cover it, the taxpayers, then what kind of a deterrent is that for him? He doesn't care. There's no skin off. He's got no skin in the game if they're covering him for doing stupid things, right?
Right.
But that's what they tell us. They say, oh, he's covered under our insurance. Nevertheless, you know, doesn't mean, I mean, you still can put a claim in, but it's just, they turn the whole bond on its head by doing that. They're defeating the purpose of it.
And there's one other thing before I forget. What Trump said about a month or so ago, he goes, let me speak the truth now. And everybody got upset. He said, quote, unquote, I am a American nationalist. And everybody's like, oh, my God. And all of a sudden we're sitting there. when we say anything, if we say we are a United States citizen or we are a citizen of the United States, that means that's under state or federal. So when you say you're an American national, that means nobody owns you.
Yeah, it's the interest of the country first, and it's not a bad thing. It's a good thing. They're making it because they're globalists. They don't want nationalism. They
right.
They want populism. They want global, one world, new world order, and they got people. Look, it's only CNN and NBC. They go, oh, my God, nationalists, because they want you to think that it's Nazism or something, but it's not.
No, it's not. That's not. And so people, I mean, we know he's off the hook, but what he said, that he is a American nationalist. And I said, oh, my God. And someone, I heard the guy said, oh, wait a minute. We learned this about 7-8 years ago. American nationalist.
Right.
You know, because it's not under state or government. And that's
well, that's one thing. He does say the right things.
Yeah, and I'm like, oh my, and I remembered, because I said, I remember everybody making a big stink. I didn't, you know, because you hear things and, you know, you're not paying too much attention. But I remember a few people were coming back saying that, and then I said, you know what, he was right when he said that.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. And so, I said, that's, yeah. But it's just so crazy what's been going on.
Well, we'll see what happens. I mean, sometimes he says stuff and I wonder why he says it, but I think he's like trying to throw him for a loop. One thing he did say is that he wanted a national ID, and that's bad. I don't know why he said that, but I haven't heard any more about that. And he might have just been throwing that out there, baiting the... You know.
He was a national ID.
Yeah, but that's no good, a national ID.
No, absolutely not, because look at all the people's identity and everything else is being stolen.
Yeah, well, it's your papers, please. It's what the Nazis did. You got to walk around with your papers all the time. You know, you got to be identified. They want face date. Your driver's license has your picture on it, and then what they're going to do is they're going to turn it into a federal national ID, which has face recognition, so they can pick you out of a crowd. This is the beginning of, you know, the whole 1984 scenario, you know, where they're in control.
Oh, my God, that's horrible.
Well, that's
when
what it is.
When did you say that?
No, that was signed into law in 2006, and we have to comply with the real ID by October of 2020, I think it is. That's it's on the books now. They voted it in when they did the Patriot Act and the NDAA and all that other crap. So our compliance is supposed to be by, you know, 97% of the states have complied with the Real ID Act, and that's a bad thing.
Are people aware of that?
Well, I don't know if they are, but, you know, Motor Vehicle is sending a lot of stuff out, and people just comply because, if you don't have it, you can't get on a plane. You can't fly any place, even in intercontinental in the United States. You won't be able to get on a plane without it. So people are stupid. They'll comply.
Yeah, I'll say people need to be aware of that. That's awful.
But anyway, all very interesting. So I'll see if we can maybe come up with some kind of statement. Call her and ask her if we can't send anybody up there, if they'll read a statement from us.
Okay, definitely.
Okay.
Yeah, definitely. And actually what everybody needs to do is have the same thing. I guess they're going to have it on. The media is going to be there, but the people are probably going to be recording it so they can blast it on YouTube. And all the states should have this.
Look, at the remedy for this is the common law grand jury. Let the common law grand jury go in there and review this. and review the judges and review the courts. That's what the problem is. They're not getting reviewed by anybody.
Well, that's what we definitely need to be heard. We'll definitely, I could maybe call you in the morning, or you could call me so we can get it together. And
right. My only reservation is we don't have enough educated people to do a review. Well, I shouldn't say that. They are, but how do you get them on the common law grand jury to do this stuff? You know, there's people out there, but it's education, like John says. People have to start getting educated, because this, in order for the system to work, you have to know the Constitution. If you don't know the Constitution, how can you uphold it? How can you do an investigation to know that they broke the law if you don't know what the law is? When I say the law, I'm talking about common law, the Constitution, the common sense.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
And see, one thing, everybody paid attention. Anything over $20, you could have a common law jury. You know? Any case that's brought before a court, you have to have it done within a... If you bring a case, you have a year and a half to present that case. Otherwise, it's default and has to be thrown out. My case has been going on 5 years. And I said, This is bogus. As a matter of fact, what they're doing on some of the docket numbers and stuff, it's all deleted, and it's like there's nothing to back this up, and they got the same docket number, and they're resurrecting new cases under the old under somebody else's old docket number.
Yeah, so the speedy trial thing is out the window, right?
Exactly. So, like, yes, that's for me to know and you to find out.
Yeah, right.
And see, all my records they sent back, and I said, wait a minute. And I have my records that they sent back, which I said, you can't tamper with evidence. And see, I caught them, and oh, by the way, there's been a big turnover in our courts down here. The clerks, all of everybody's jumping ship.
Yeah, well, there's probably investigations coming from on top, this whole thing that with Donald Trump and these new prosecutors he's putting in. You're going to start seeing reverberations from that, I am sure. And so this is a great time for you. You know, your timing right now, Crystal, is dead on, right on. You know, this is the time for your case to be going through with all this stuff that's going on in the nation. So... because otherwise, you may never get. You know, they would just ignore you and do what they do best, and steamroll you.
Mm.
So anyway, that sounds good,
okay.
Crystal.
Well, I will get back.
We'll be in touch. Yeah.
Yes, this is Gerard.
Yes, it is.
Okay, how are you doing?
I'm doing all right.
All right, because I had something for you. I can give you a call tomorrow morning.
Yeah, what's tomorrow? Tomorrow's Tuesday, right?
Are you? Yeah, cause I.
Yeah, call me tomorrow. You're going to call from a 203 number. That's your area code.
Right. Okay, I'll get that. All right, and I'll have all that other info, because
okay.
I got to get it right out of here in the morning. So I'll try to call you before 9-ish.
Okay, Crystal.
Okay, take care.
Yeah, thank you. God bless.
You too.
Okay. That was Crystal. Let's see. Veronica from PA, you're up. Speak now or forever hold your peace.
Can you hear me?
I can, yes.
It's moot now. When John was talking at the beginning of the call, and it was already on the recording and everything, and he had mentioned Bush rather than Trump in something he said. But I can understand. Today is the day, you know, the burials and stuff like that of Bush, President Bush. So I can imagine that he must have been on his mind. But anyway, I was just going to bring it to his attention, but, you know, that was when I pushed the button. About 10 minutes in, and here I am.
Yeah.
So
well,
that's all
know,
I got to say. I enjoyed the call tonight. It was very interesting.
Yeah.
Well, by the way, the UCC connection, that was Howard Freeman is the fellow who was who had put that forth way back when, back in the 90s, actually. This old book,
right, right, right.
20 years old. Okay?
Yeah,
and,
thank you.
And in Pennsylvania, it's the municipal authorities. The fellow was talking, oh, gosh, it was something that was said. But I went ahead and I dropped about the municipal authorities has taken over, actually, the power of the people as far as Article 1, Section 2 of the Pennsylvania Constitution. And they did that in 1968 with the Constitutional Convention they had here. And you guys in New York actually had one around that time, too, didn't you?
Yeah, I think it was, I don't remember exactly what year it was, but it was around then, yeah.
Yeah, because I know in, when I was looking at the Constitution of New York back in the late 90s, for, you know, another reason, I noticed that allodial titles were taken out of the New York Constitution in 1968. So when I heard about that, you know, the 67-68 convention here in Pennsylvania, which I wasn't in the state at the time, I thought to myself, that's interesting. This was all after the silver was taken out of the coin and they breached, the legislators had breached their constitutional obligations to us, their, you know, the contract law. And that's Article 1, Section 10, took silver out of the coin. They, you know, no obligation of contract to the people anymore. They have bonded, bundled, and monetized us based on... what do they call that? One of the first things that's mentioned in Article 1, Section 10, the bills of credit. This is the way they bond, bundle, and monetize without full disclosure of the nature of the contracts that they're putting us into through the municipal authorities. And when you read that first paragraph of the municipal authorities that I sent you from the legislator's desk book here in Pennsylvania from 2017, you'll see that they have this big knot, that they're not this, they're an agency, this, that, and the other thing. And then it goes on to say that they are a corporate entity, I'm kind of doing it off the top of my head, that, well, it's right there. I kind of took it out and put it in your chat area there, Gerard.
So so basically what they're saying is they don't have any authority.
Well, nevertheless, for reasons of public policy and convenience, a municipal authority is not, and you see the word capitalized, not, the creature, agent, or representative of the municipality or the municipalities organizing it, but rather it is a separate and distinct entity. A municipal authority is an independent agency of the Commonwealth, a part of the Commonwealth's sovereignty, defined as, quote, a body politic and corporate. A municipal authority may be said to be an independent corporate agent of the Commonwealth exercising governmental as well as private corporate power in assisting the Commonwealth in meeting the needs of its citizens.
Assisting the Commonwealth of stripping the people of their rights is what they're doing. They're raising the corporate into a personhood is what they're doing.
Sure, and the Bar Association literally took over the authority of the people to, you know, to do the political, you know, process that it's supposed to do, that the people are supposed to do in Pennsylvania. Furthermore, what it did was under Article 1, Section 12, it gave the bar, members of the bar, the Bar Association, the ability to suspend laws because it says that no law shall be suspended unless by the legislature or by its authority. So who has become the authority over the legislators if it's no longer the people under Article 1, Section 2?
Well, just the way they write that on the face of it, it's fraud. They're telling you what they're doing, and it's fraud.
No kidding.
If you read what they're saying they are and who they are, they're admitting to you that they're an independent agency, which proves that they're a fraud.
Right. Oh, and this goes back to the school districts, because you'll see in that PDF that I sent, shows in there that school districts come under that, the municipal authorities. Okay?
Very good.
So it's just another rock unturned.
Yeah. Well, if we keep turning them up, maybe we can throw them out of the garden and plant some flowers for a change. Well, anyway.
We will know the truth, and the truth shall set us free.
Right.
Well, it's just that simple.
It's getting to be more truth than you can swallow, practically. But very good. That's good stuff. Hopefully, we can take it and do something with it now.
I think so, because from what I understand, Trezevant, are you familiar with that case, Trezevant?
Yes.
Yes, okay. And that was a municipal authority, the city of Tampa, okay? So there is some precedence about these municipal authorities, and they're nationwide, okay?
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Bye-bye now.
Yeah. Bye-bye. Okay, we're going to do Daniel from Utah. You got a few minutes. Go ahead.
Yeah, can you hear me well?
Yes, I can.
Okay. I have a comment on the lawyers and attorneys. My understanding is the lawyers are supposed to represent rule of law, but the attorneys at law are more like outlaws or barrister bankers there to collect your revenue like the banks do. So when you sign your citation, it's like if you don't sign it right, challenging jurisdiction, you're basically giving them permission to access your treasury, your social security account, to pull funds out of there, just like getting a bank loan. Does that sound accurate?
Yeah. That's a lot of people don't understand that whole process about how they float a bond, pulling funds in your name, and that's kind of something that I discovered with under the In Power with Cal. He talked about using the bond that they create in your name and laying it up to pay off, to set off the charge that they have in the court with you. And I think, I'm not sure now, don't quote me because I don't have it all down pat, but I think he made the judge the trustee or something, so they would have to exercise.
Right,
that.
And that's what I've heard.
And they get very upset with that. They don't know what to do because you're not supposed to know about that. You know what I mean?
They want to charge you twice instead of just once.
Right. Well, look, if you don't know about that bond, they'll go ahead and give you a fine, and you pay the fine. And that bond will still float forward, and they'll trade it on the open market. And that's where they get these millions and billions of dollars from, because they trade them on the market. They sell them and trade them, and you know what I mean? And it becomes like
securities.
An instrument, right.
So a comment
exactly.
On the...
That's the problem. What's that?
So a comment, the birth certificate is a national ID, in a sense, that they use to trade as securities and profit off of without telling you about it. And I guess supposedly when you become an adult, you're supposed to have a right to access that and get the interest paid on it and stuff.
There's people that do it, but a lot of people end up going to jail because they don't know. Look, you can set off bills with that, but I don't know that you can take money out of it. See, people get
that's
in trouble
what I've heard.
When they try to take money out of it. Like they'll send you the check because you're putting a bill in. It's like an accepted for value bill, but if it's false, if you're just putting in something that's really not, it's not a tax bill or it's not some kind of municipal bill, because that was supposed to be the remedy for them taking our rights away and taking the gold out of the money and stuff.
So as long as it's a bill that supports the corporation, then you can use it for that and they don't bother you.
Right. But as far as going in and take money out, that's where they get into trouble. Which I think, look at it, if you can figure out how to get them to pay your bills, why would you need money? Just get them to pay your bills if that's the case.
Well, if you can buy an automobile, and that would be
a
good thing.
Exactly. Or a house. Or whatever.
So this account is, I mean, as a human being, if a child is born without an inheritance, they're basically a property and a slave of a corporation, right? And so if they have a right to an inheritance through a trust account that they have a right to access that represents their allegiance to their neighbor's common law natural rights, then that creates a trust based on a rule of law where every person is given an opportunity and freedom to create wealth for the whole community through teamwork and sharing knowledge and information. But they haven't told the people about that, but also I don't think they didn't base the cat, I don't think, on common law, which was a huge, big mistake, I think. Well, maybe a little bit of common law there. I'm not sure. I don't know the details, but I think the whole nation, actually the creation of the national currency should be based on allegiance to natural physical rights, common law rights, because the currency actually enforces rule of law, and if the currency is not based on the law, it violates the law.
Right.
And the true accounting of real value is rights, not any idol such as property or gold. Rights is the true standard of God to measure value, how much we uphold and serve rights based on natural and eternal abundance and sustainability. And a comment about the national ID. I'm thinking the birth certificate is a national ID, but maybe they want to put a chip in us so they can track us and everything we do and all our transactions. Or put a chip in a card that's a national ID so they can track everything. But if that was based on common law and rule of law, it wouldn't be so bad. But even then, we shouldn't have a chip in there because it's a violation of privacy. But if we had a national ID without any electronic tracking and it was based on allegiance to constitutional, natural, common law rights, I think that would actually be a good thing, but that's not what they want to do. They want to use this as property of the corporation.
Well, you know, this plan can only be, it's so diabolical, only the devil could have dreamed it up, because think about it. They do the birth certificate thing, right? And they got the parents as a witness and the doctor, this or that. And that puts the child into,
corporate trust.
Right, that parenthood of the state, right? But it really gets sealed every time you do something else in life. You're reaffirming and getting deeper into it, like your driver's license and then your social security.
Every contract with the corporation, you get deeper in the
right. So
slavery.
With the birth certificate, you didn't personally agree to. So you have an out because it's sort of an adhesion contract, right? You could say,
right.
Well, I didn't really agree to it. I understand my parents had the rights to make decisions for me. However, it wasn't a fully informed decision, and now that I've reached the age of reason, I'm able to make that decision. But, you know, the minute
you're... age of responsible adult, then you have the right to choose.
Right. So if you didn't take those contracts to that's what sucks you in deeper. Of course, it's all fraud. We know it's fraud because they don't tell you what they're doing to you.
It's not.
Or they don't even tell you. You don't really need a license to drive a car because what's a license? A license is permission to do something that would otherwise be illegal. Well, why is driving a car illegal?
A privilege is not a right, yeah. And so they violate your right by saying you have to get a privilege.
Exactly. So I think as people become more educated in this stuff, I think the nails are going in their coffin. I think you're going to see the death throes coming pretty soon, because we have some educators out there.
I think what will speed it up probably more than anything is that people realize that the most powerful law is actually the law of a national currency. And if people get together and start creating credit unions or a national currency based on allegiance to physical common law rights, constitutional rights, then that actually is, because really economics is government. If people don't have a currency that enforces those rights, then we're unknowingly maybe abusing each other and violating each other's rights without realizing it.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're using an accounting system that's in treason against rule of law and rights instead of enforcing rule of law and rights.
Right. Well, biggest fear is people waking up, because once people wake up, you can't put them back to sleep.
Yes.
You can never tell them the lie again. Once you wake up, you're never gonna The only way they can put you back to sleep is to physically give you a frontal lobotomy. You know what I mean?
Right. I think that's why they're trying to steal people's wealth through their trust accounts and security accounts and through the corrupt laws and through removing of rights through privileges and bribes. Because when people are poor and constantly intimidated, their mind doesn't work straight. They live in fear and slavery rather than awareness.
Well, if you got to worry about your next meal and paying the next bill, you don't really have a lot of time or resources to fight them, do you?
Yeah, Stephen, pay attention to what's going on. You're just thinking about how do I get some food so I don't starve.
Exactly. So, and that's where they keep us best.
Yes, and once we create a currency based on rights and it comes from the people, not the counterfeiters, then we can create wealth really fast because we're not being robbed through taxes and inflation and all this secret combinations of, you know, covering up the technology and promoting lies in every aspect of the corporation, whether it's health or economics or religion or, you know, all of it, right, property rights and all that, law. It's all counterfeit, you know. And it's done through the economic system because we've accepted their mark of counterfeit accounting and give that power over our life. And so they use that to tell us all these lies and convince us that it's the truth.
Well, look, I didn't think I'd ever live to see today when you actually had a president talking against the Federal Reserve, the central bank. We're back in the Andrew Jackson days. This is very exciting. And people support that when it comes up. We have to show that he has a mandate of the people. They're acting like he's a kook. Meanwhile, this is exactly where we want to be. And every other president that ever talked about it, they got a bullet. You know what I mean? In rare form. And not only presidents, but even foreign guys that wanted to go off of the petrodollar. They made sure when Gaddafi and Hussein decided they weren't going to take paper fiat money and they only wanted gold or silver, that's when their reign, you know, they were puppet guys that were raised by this whole cabal, and they broke away from it. And once they started doing that, they had to go, and they definitely, you know, they made sure that they murdered them eventually, you know.
Right. If there's enough people awake and they're actually the people themselves establishing and enforcing common law through an honest currency, then at that point, the president can actually help the people to change the whole system to rule of law.
Look, it can happen tomorrow if we had a good media. The media is the biggest obstacle because they're lying and they're not reporting things. People would get on real quick because they're not getting the proper news. They're not getting the right stuff. There is no real reporting going on. But look, we're getting late. I don't want the recording to go too late. This has been a real lively call. We've really bounced around and touched everything. But this is good.
Thank you guys very much.
Yeah, yeah. Right, we appreciate it. And we got a lot of good people with a lot of good minds, you know. So you got to keep chipping away at it. And the more we do, the quicker that statue with the clay feet and the steel is going to crumble, you know.
Amen. Amen.
Okay. Well, have a good night. God bless everybody, and that's our show, and we'll be back here next week, same time.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, you too. Good night.